Welcome back to Ladies with Gumption. I am your host, or not host.
Hostess with the mostest.
The hostess, I'm the pre-host, May, and I'm here with...
Tatiana.
And Jessica.
And this is our 32nd episode titled Leveling Up. Once again, we recap DCTV in a flash. You can find us on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can email us your long, lovely thoughts at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. You can also find all of our podcasts on ladieswgumption.podomatic.com, which is the main site. You can find us on iTunes and Google Play and our Facebook, which three people like. It's okay. I understand. I complain about this every week, but it's all right. But you can also send us your thoughts via our individual Tumblrs. Tatiana is Valerie Ann Perez, Jessica is Falling in Love in a Flash, and I am her own hero writer. We would love to always hear from you. This week we have a comment from Ebony Angel Vibes, who left us a Podomatic comment. She says she loves our podcast and apologizes for not listening every week, but listens when she can. Thank you for that. What she loves about us, she says, is that we're objective versus subjective. We like to think we are most of the time, so thank you. and that we stand by our truths. But she also loves that we address a lot of the diversity challenges that go along with comic book shows, and particularly in fandoms where some of the audience have issues with race bending of the female lead and other types of characters. And she usually finds herself agreeing with us and what we say, and wanted to thank us for taking the time to do the podcast, and loves hearing women of color repping in the comic book genre. Thank you so much, Ebony. We really, really appreciate that.
Aw, yes. Thank you. And thank you for your questions, your asks on Tumblr as well. I always enjoy receiving them.
She sent me an ask. She's like, I don't want to keep bothering Tati.
What? I'm being cheated on.
So thank you for that. I appreciate the love. Yes, give Tati a break. Sometimes. In news, we have a shocking but pleasing move. For Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow, co-showrunner Mark Guggenheim will be taking a step back on both shows, going from showrunner to consultant. Wendy Miracle will be stepping down as well, but she will not become a consultant. I think she's going to another show. And Beth Schwartz, who was an executive producer, will be promoted to sole Arrow showrunner. Over on Legends, Phil Klemmer will also be the sole showrunner, so Guggenheim's out. And there will be an announcement for who Macy Richardson Sellers will be playing in Legends Season 4, and that will be announced at San Diego Comic-Con. Tasha, our friendly Arrow correspondent, thinks Beth Schwartz becoming showrunner will breathe new life into the show, and she hasn't been this excited about the potential for the show in a long time. She thinks it's definitely good to have a woman running the show so they can shake things up a bit for season 7. So that's exciting. It's at least good that they're, you know, they have a female showrunner, which is going to be interesting because I feel like Arrow is the most masculine show in the Arrowverse. In what appears to be the Arrowverse goof of the week, Stephen Amell poked the Bayhive when he tweeted that he would be purposefully leaving before Baychella commenced. Then he proceeded to make things worse by taking Walmart Batman to heart, which, you know, he's been called this for years. I don't know why he suddenly cares.
I do, Steven.
Right? He tweeted, like, a gazillion memes. He called Beyonce's fans fucking losers, and I quote, and then made fun of accents on names. So, like, we don't think he intended for half these things to happen or to be as big of a deal, but he's a public figure, so sometimes you just gotta stay quiet. And we were discussing amongst ourselves that if we have to give him advice to follow in Grant Gustin's footsteps post-meltdown, which means apologize, delete, and shut up, then you know you have a problem. So, I mean, this is not the first time I think Steven suffers from, like, ego problems. He never apologizes, which is a problem. Tasha weighed in on this when she sent us an email, and she agrees that Steven should have just let it go, like Elsa. And she thinks his ego got in the way, which I absolutely agree with. And since he is a public figure, he'll always have to deal with the blowbacks for things he says. But that continuing the argument was completely pointless. Like, it's Friday, and I think it's still, people are still tweeting about it.
I mean, like, that's the thing, because it's like, a lot of the stuff that people were saying to him was really mean and necessary, you know? But, like, we can acknowledge that. But still, for him to then try to acknowledge it and try to, like, make himself look like the victim is not going to be a good look. You know, no one's going to react well to that. Even, you know, journalists and a bunch of verified accounts are out there making fun of him now and talking about how Arrow is a low-rated, terrible show, etc. It's probably not the publicity that they wanted for the last, yeah, few episodes.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And then Tasha also pretty much thinks the same, and she thinks that anyone, like, we as a people are not going to be able to teach a privileged, and I quote, privileged white man why Beyonce is such a symbol of importance and black excellence for them by attacking him, his job, and his family, just like you said, Tati. And she thinks it could have been a teachable moment, but it just devolved into chaos. She also thinks that calling someone a racist because they put an accent above a letter, didn't put an accent above a letter on someone's name, is a lot.
Yeah, I feel like for me, like, the whole, when seeing the whole thing play out, my answer is like a collection of memes. Like, the first one's like, be quiet, Tiffany. Like, you know, just like, shut up and eat your food, Steven. Go home. I think it would have played out better if he had, because I think later he was trying to play it off as like, I was trying to be traffic. But if he had tweeted something like, thank you, Beyonce, for distracting 90% of the Coachella audience so I can get home on time, that would have played off a lot better than what he wrote. Because he was trying to be Shady Boots, and it was not the night to be Shady Boots. And they came for him. And, you know, if he had just stopped at Walmart Batman and not continued with, like, the 300 memes, it would have been, haha, funny. He could have, like, laughed off. But then, like, his wife also put, like, Walmart Batwoman, which was just, like, a whole bunch of L's, seeing as how they're... And she's a lesbian, but whatever. And then, like, the thing with the name, I kind of agree with Tasha that that was definitely not where Steven was thinking that was going to go. But I also agree with, like, the content of the thread and the way that that kind of played out. Because the Beehive are already upset in the first place. So, of course, they're anything they're going to, you know, look at him. And if he's not spelling her name correctly, they're going to be like, put some respect on her name. And then he responded like that SpongeBob, put some respect in her name. Kind of. And then he got what he got. So then it was like, Beyonce, sweetie, I'm so sorry that this ugly bitch would say that. Oh, my God. And he gives a whole long thread. Moral of the story, quit. Take the L.
Yeah, quit while you're not ahead.
Quit while you're not ahead. Just take the L, apologize, let it go.
For the first time, all he should have been like, when he started realizing, and people started coming for him pretty soon after that. So, like, you'd think that as soon as he said he'll come for him, be like, oh, no, I had to get home on time for this reason, but Beyonce's great. All right, the end.
I think he waited too long to
he waited, like, a whole day, and then was like, I watched the live stream, and it was amazing. I was like, okay, you did not, because otherwise you would have said you were watching the live stream. And you
right.
just had to get home early.
Right. Like, just be like, yeah, I didn't mean to disrespect her in any kind of way. I think yesterday he was tweeting a CNN correspondent about coming on his podcast so they can talk about it. Like, he was doing too much. So, yeah, Steven, please, just stay in your corner. So maybe it's time to, like, be like Oliver this week and not come online.
All it would right. probably play off better than yeah. Oliver not getting on the show
now. Right, right. All right, so our format this week, as usual, Supergirl, except Legends is no longer, we're no longer talking about Legends. Supergirl's back, and we'll be discussing Supergirl and Black Lightning on side A.
That's canceled. Next show, Supergirl.
We forgot about Supergirl.
That's not canceled, though,
it's
by the way.
It's not canceled, but it is.
Supergirl and Black Lightning on side A, and Mini Krypton, Flash, and Arrow on side B. Again, we'll talk about our likes and dislikes, season predictions, and nominate and then crown a Lady with Gumption of the Week. We will begin with side A, Supergirl, Black Lightning, Childish Things, / Memory Lane, and we'll have our lovely Jessica to take it away with the recaps.
Okay, so I'm Supergirl. Wynn is living his best life enjoying karaoke with his friends until a news report comes on saying his criminal father, Toyman, has died. Wynn is not sure how he feels about this news, but his best friend, James, is there to stay by his side while he processes the news. At the funeral, Wynn is burying one parent when the other parent, his long-lost mother, Mary, shows up after 20 years to reconnect. However, Toyman has one last trick up his sleeve and blows up his own coffin in an attempt to kill Wynn and Mary. Luckily, Supergirl is there to protect them. Back at the DEO, Wynn is forced to spend some quality time with his mom. Kara questions whether Toyman is actually dead, but Wynn assures her that he is definitely dead, and this is the last trick of a madman. Wim's attempts to avoid his mother and his patients run out. So Mary tries to apologize for leaving and wants to protect Wynn now, but Wynn angrily and tearfully rejects her help, telling her instead how he felt the night his father went crazy and got locked up, and how she never came to pick him up from the police station. Flying mechanical monkeys interrupt their conversation, attacking the DEO to kill the shots. Tar, Jeans, and Mon-El take them out. Wynn takes the monkey and tries to find where it came from, and Mary takes the opportunity to help him and tell him the real reason that she left. She tried to escape with Wynn before, but Winston ran them off the road and threatened to kill them both. She apologizes again, and Wynn seems to take it to heart, but when Mary finds a clue on the monkey, the name of the toy factory where it was created, she hides it, steals a gun, and goes to take care of the situation herself. The actual culprit behind the tricks is a crazy lady who claims to be Winston's apprentice and executor of his will to kill Wynn if Mary showed up, and this whole part of the plot is just fucking dumb. The apprentice lures Supergirl to the factory, Mon-El and Kara team up while James and Wynn rescue his mom. Elsewhere, Alex wants her alien dad to invite her over to his new place for dinner so she can get to know her space granddad. Alex learns why John chose to live on Earth as a black man, and things seem to be going well at first until Alex notices these little signs that Mirren is entering early onset dementia. She confronts him, and he's aware, but gets angry when she suggests that she'll tell John if he won't. John is confused by why his dad and his daughter don't seem to be getting along, but Alex abides by Mirren's wishes and tells John to talk to his dad about what's going on, and finally Mirren tells him the truth. Almost lastly, Mon-El, who's been whining and pouting the whole entire episode because his wife and best friend lied to him, keeps wanting to get Kara alone. He apologizes for his past behavior, but Kara, picking up on the not-so-platonic vibes he's putting down, accepts his apology but clarifies that she's not that kind of friend and respectfully asks him to keep his distance. And then finally, James is blowing up Lena's phone, even though they're not in a relationship, according to him. And when she finally answers, it's to lie to him about where she and Sam are. To the outside world, they're swamped, working on a startup, but secretly, in an undisclosed location of L Corp, Lena is trying to find a way to stop Sam from becoming Rain. And that's what she missed on Supergirl. What did we like about this episode?
Ooh, I mean,
I really...
no, I did like a lot about this episode. It was a good episode overall. I'll leave that for another show inside B. On this show, I really enjoyed Alex and how she insisted John and Mirren have a housewarming party and invited herself over, or had them invite her over, because, you know, she just wanted to be there. She's family. And I really love her and John's relationship, and it feels very natural and genuine and a testament to how close they are in terms of being a father-daughter relationship on the show. And I think at this point, it's safe to say that Alex has become the heart of Supergirl and kind of the emotional tether. So this episode really showcased that. Like, she was the only one to truly bond with Mirren, and that's because she loves John so much. And I also really love the fact that Mirren felt like she was a granddaughter of sorts to him, and how she didn't betray his promise, or the promise she made him, by not telling John herself. This led to a really sad but touching scene between the two Martians, and that really tugged at my heartstrings and finally gave more focus to the relationship, which has been sorely lacking. Jeremy Jordan can act, y'all. Woohoo! He finally got something to do as Wynn.
Surprise.
I know. Finally got something to do as Wynn this season, and he acted his ass off. Laurie Metcalf as well is always great, so I'm glad she got to share a lot of scenes with him, and it was like a really good reminder that he is a good actor, since this show really does him a disservice. I was surprised but happy that it was James who got to go and talk to Wynn, not once but twice. I feel like it's a great continuity from last season when they were teaming up together during James's Guardian run, and so James being there for Wynn made a lot of sense, and it was really nice to see. Kara, okay. Karaoke. was super fun, and it was really nice to see them all leave the DEO so we can remember that they do have lives outside the cave of technology. I actually really appreciated Mon-El apologizing to Kara for lying last year. I feel like it's the most honest he's been with her in a long time, if ever. And it's like the writers were atoning for their sins. I also felt like his immediate honesty with Kara meant something. And even briefly, Kara actually told him that he shouldn't talk to her about his marriage problems, which I thought was very immature, even though that's not what he was going to talk to her about. I did like that the show explored the dimensions of Mary's absence instead of making her super neglectful mother who was just bad at parenting, and they gave her a reason for why she left, and even though it may not justify her being gone for 20 years, at least there was some kind of understanding, and I like that the show did that.
Are those all your likes?
Yes.
Okay, I agree with all these likes for the most part. I was surprised because Jessica and I and Ivy, who is Miss Minute 42 on Twitter, had written an article on withanaccent.com, thank you, Jessica, about what Supergirl needs to do better. And in Jessica's point, she talked about the men on the show, and she specifically mentioned that David Harewood said in interviews why John chose to be a black man, and yet John has never said that. There's never been any indication of that being a black man would be in any way harder than anything else. And finally, in this episode, Alex is literally like, hey, why are you a black man?
I'm so powerful. I made it happen.
Exactly. Her mind. Finally, John's power was useful for something.
Yeah.
So anyway, I like that. It was like a little bit on the nose, as Supergirl tends to be, but hey, it's out there, and now we know why John chose to stay as Hank Henshaw. So, yes, that was great. Anyway, other things that I love, which was really that, the John, Mirren, and Alex part of the story was really my favorite part of the episode. Just because, well, I love all those actors, obviously, and I love all those dynamics. I hadn't even, you know, like, Mirren and Alex is not like a dynamic that I thought about, but to actually see them interacting, that she really does feel like another child, you know, an extension of the family. Like, he talked about, like, when he was, like, talking about her being so close to John, and then he said, I've always wanted a granddaughter, or something like that, which was, of course, heartbreaking, because he did have granddaughters that he can't remember. But it was also a very sweet sentiment towards Alex, even though at first, for a second, I thought that he meant that he wanted her to marry John and then have grandkids. And I was like, what? That's not what we're going for here. And I was like, oh, no. I understand what's happening. But anyway, I love that Alex does feel like John's daughter. And I always want more of that. I want more of that with Kara, but, you know, that's all right. That's a separate point. That's the part that they have not yet done from our articles. Still got to work on that. I also like Alex opening up about her own grandmother and talking to Mirren about it. And how, May pointed out, she respected Mirren enough not to talk to John about it on her own. But she also respected John enough to give him a heads up that he needed to talk to his father so that they could work it out. I also love that hug, like when he came to the karaoke bar, or just the bar afterward, and Alex saw him and she knew that he knew. You know, and then they hug each other. It was very sweet. Like, a moment of comfort. And it's like, he's not upset that she didn't tell him or anything. Like, there's a lot of melodramatic things that you could have done with it. And instead, it was just two friends or family, you know, looking out for each other. Aside from that, Jeremy Jordan knocked it out of the park. He is a great performer. He finally got a chance to perform. Because the show doesn't really give him... I feel like the last time that he really acted was in the crossover. And that was on the Flash part. Of the crossover, where he finally got to, like, really get a meaty storyline to play. So this time, he finally got one on his own show, and he had a great dynamic with Roy Metcalf, but it was also really believable how he was torn about what happened, like, his father dying, right? Because, like, even though he's a criminal and a horrible person, and obviously they didn't have the best relationship, it's still his dad, you know, and he still has memories from his childhood that now are even worse because now he learns a totally different version of it from his mother. So it is a lot to process, and it's too bad that he won't get more episodes after this to process it, probably. But watching it this time around was interesting. And I also liked, you know, that she wasn't the villain for leaving. I was concerned when she came back that it was like some kind of fakery, that she was the one that was actually going to be against him or like planning something. But thankfully not. Instead, there was someone else that we will talk about. But... But I was glad that they got to patch up their relationship, and that we can imagine that he is visiting with his mother off screen in future episodes. Finally, I loved the bromance moments with John. I just said John. The bromance moments with James and Wynn, because we haven't really gotten much of that this season, and they had such a great arc together as Guardian. It was so much fun to see them just hanging out. So now it was nice to see.
It wasn't great.
Well, their dynamic was great. Guardian was not great. James and Wynn is great.
To clarify.
Yes. Thank you, Jessica. Specifically, their friendship was great. So I'm glad that we got a little bit of that back, that James was really a supportive friend, and also gave him some really great advice to help him keep an open mind. Not finally. I was really happy that Monel told Kara about the Legion, and that they were after Pestilence, and that Kara got to say, I don't want you coming on to me or you bitching about your wife, because it's fucking weird for me, because I'm your ex, and, you know, totally love you. It was, I remember when she said it, I was like, this is really weird, like, why is this happening? But at the same time, I was glad that she did it, because you had to do it at some point. And how else can they show you that there is awkward tension between them, unless she says, there is awkward tension between us, I don't like it. So, good job, guys. Everyone, good job. I liked his cake trick that he did when they were fighting whatever her name was. And I liked that he offered to teach it to her, because she taught him a bunch of things last year, so it was about time he returned the favor. And, yeah, the whole fight sequence was fun. It was cool to see Kara fighting, and then Monel actually being useful after several episodes of the Legion doing nothing. Finally, I loved all of the karaoke scenes. It's great to see characters have fun, be supportive of each other. You know, Makkad actually got to show off his singing chops that I didn't know that would ever happen. And also, I feel like they made him sound like the best one. Like, James is the best singer now. Because, like, the others, they, like, down, like, you know, Alex, even though Kyler is an amazing singer, Alex just started, like, drinking, or, like, you know, she couldn't continue with the song and started drinking. And I feel like with Wynn and his mom, like, obviously Jeremy, again, amazing singer, and they were like, that wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be. I was just like, oh, okay, having fun. So, you know, I guess James can sing now. That's
yeah,
all.
Yeah, I think overall this episode was really solid for Supergirl, especially for coming back after such a long hiatus. I really enjoyed the karaoke and seeing most of the group get to hang out and have fun together, like you guys said. And then, minus, like, the legends, which they're just, like, having fun all the time because they're just, like, fucking up shit and not caring. I feel like a lot of other shows, so, you know, what's left is Arrow and The Flash. They don't really do that, much of that anymore, where people, I don't know if they ever did that on Arrow, where you just, like, have fun. So it's nice to see that, you know, people do have lives outside of, like, the DEO or Star Labs or the Arrow Cave or the Wave Rider, wherever the place may be. I was especially glad to see that John let Mirren have the house so he could have a good time. Because, like, Mirren's weird for episodes at a time. And I just feel like he sits at home and does nothing. I love Alex and Mirren and John's dynamic and how she was so insistent on getting an invite to dinner. She's, like, she's basically saying, you have adopted me. I am your daughter. You're going to invite me over to your house. Like, happening right now. So, I mean, and I love that their dynamic and that she got to learn more about Mirren and how she and John feel like a true, like, father-daughter relationship. I like that James got so much to do for him, because he usually doesn't, support-wise, particularly as it relates to Wynn, because like Tasha said, they spent so much time developing James' Wynn dynamic in season 2. It was nice to see that play a big role in season 3, so it's not like all of a sudden they forget that James is a big part of Wynn's life or whatever. They still have that connection, and I like that James was there to support Wynn and just, like, not leave him alone and say, I'll be here for you. So I thought that was really nice. There's other things that James did that I didn't like, so I'm gonna put those in my dislikes, but it's nothing to do with Wynn. So I liked his relationship with Wynn a lot. Jeremy Jordan, fantastic in this episode. Really like the scene where he confronts his mother and, like, he talks about that night that he was left alone, really, like, kind of touched me. And that was because you could see, like, just the anger and the sadness and everything, like, in his face. So I thought he acted that out particularly well. And then Laurie Metcalf, also on the flip side, when she's telling him about her story, it really made me feel for both of their situations. And it also kind of, with hearing all of Wynn's backstory is, and knowing his history with his father, is kind of like a testament to Wynn that he grew up to be the man that he is. He's accomplished as he is now, when easily it could have gone down a different route. I thought that with Mary's story, I do appreciate the writers not glossing over the fact that she continued to be gone for 20 years. So she, like, gave her story, and she's like, you know, it's still not an excuse. I could have come back sooner. But, you know, and so this kind of has, like, a little bit of layers for them. And it makes me glad that John was there. Sorry, not John, but James was there in the beginning to tell Wynn to, like, you know, be open, be receptive, see what she has to say, kind of thing. And then, surprisingly, Monel didn't bother me as much. And minus some annoying parts that you guys kind of mentioned, but I'll just mention it in my dislikes. I feel like this is the most seamlessly he's been integrated into the team. Like, he had conversations with different characters. He helped in the fight sequences, and he apologized to Kara, and I thought that was really all good things for him. And it continues to show the writers' attempts to rectify what they knew they did wrong. So it's like they realized their mistakes from last season, and they're trying to correct it, which is good and bad, because it just means that they're trying so hard because they don't want him to go anywhere. They want to keep him in the show for now. So, you know, it could go either way, whether you like Mon-El or you don't like Mon-El. I feel like there was some kind of reference I was supposed to get with Wizard of Oz, and I didn't get it. But I like the flying monkeys, and I thought that fight sequence with the flying monkeys and the D.O. and Kara was some of her best, like, fight choreography ever. And so that's probably my favorite fight sequence I've ever seen of her, but I thought that was really well done with the visual effects and everything. So that is all that I liked. So what did we not like about this episode?
Well, I was going to say about the Wizard of Oz references, I didn't really get why the flying monkeys either. I just noticed that they used the flying monkeys from the Wizard of Oz, but I don't know why they did it. So I don't know.
I mean, like, the Twin Man doesn't really get, like, make a direct reference to the wizard unless, like, the W. I didn't get it. Someone got it. No.
It's like, did we miss something? Were we looking down? I don't know.
It's like a popular toy. I don't know. I want to start by saying that several parts of the episode felt like Groundhog Day. We had the same exact conversations being repeated over and over again, and there was no progress being made. Like, I'm totally fine. Like, y'all know I love filler episodes. Filler episodes are where I live. And this was going to be a filler episode. This is what I was prepared for. I was like, all right, it's going to be all win all the time, and also
Filler Town USA.
Yes. And also surprise John and Mirren all the time. This is great. But then instead, we need some plot, but we can only do like one scene worth of plot. So we're going to just have James leave three of the same messages for Lena just at the end. We can find out that she's doing exactly what you would expect her to do when she learned about Sam. Like, why did we need a surprise shock final scene to learn that Lena is working on fixing Sam in the bunker of Elcor or wherever the fuck they are? Like, obviously that's what she's doing. In fact, I was more confused about why no one else cared where Lena was. Did Kara not invite Lena to the karaoke? Did Lena respond to Kara but not to James? Like, suddenly Lena is not part of his friend group, and Sam too. They're just missing and nobody cares. They just forgot that they existed, except for James, who also, for some reason, does not sound like he gives a fuck about Lena and doesn't want to date her. So it was really weird. He's the only one who cares about Lena, but also the one that's like, is she my girlfriend? Or is she just like a girl that I am friends with? And sometimes our mouths meet. Like, okay. But anyway, he should be over the moon about dating her. I don't understand. Instead, he's like the living embodiment of meh. I also don't know why Mon-El and Kara had to have three versions of the same scene just so that he could finally tell her something that Imra and Brainiac should have told her the second that Rain showed up. Like, it doesn't make any sense why they would keep this information a secret, and it makes everyone involved look incompetent. Like, as soon as you hear World Killer, presumably you know that Pestilence was a world killer and became blight, right? You already knew this information. That's why you came back here. It'd be a really hard thing to forget about. And instead, I feel like everyone was like, I don't really know how you guys solved this problem. I don't know. I guess, like, you just had a problem and then you solved it. So we'll just wait around until our problem arrives. Thank you. Okay, whatever. It is stupid. And it also makes Mon-El look not trustworthy because they obviously did not trust him enough to think that he would still want to help, despite his fee-fees for Kara. So, I guess he's just not that great of a hero. Anyway, as soon as the Toymaker Mistress showed up, that plotline derailed. Like, the Wynn and, I keep wanting to call him Jeremy, the Wynn and
Mary.
Thank you, because I was going to call her Laurie Metcalf, yes. So, the Wynn and Mary plotline was really interesting, like, emotionally speaking. And then there's like a second toy maker, and it's actually the toy maker's like girlfriend, jailer person, janitor. I don't know what she was. She like worked at the jail and somehow learned from him and loved him, and it's just bullshit. And yeah, I would just rather have them working things out or have the dad still be alive and have faked his death just to be like, psych, and prove some kind of point. And instead, it was just a weird version of trickster and prank, But where Prank is, like, really sad and pathetic and, like, has absolutely no reason to be here. So, yeah, I didn't like that.
I mean, I completely agree about James. That was, like, with your... like, when the show began moving in the direction of James and Lena, I thought that they could finally have a relationship that was good for both of them. Instead, we got James looking reluctant to say he was even in a relationship, and it's odd to me that someone who looks like they could have a lot of confidence in themselves is unsure about whether to move forward with Lena fucking Luther. Like, I don't understand. And I thought they were over the hurdles of Lena being a Luther and her being his boss, but I guess I was wrong because he's not all in yet. And it's just a bunch of weirdness going on that I don't really like, and I don't like where it's going. And while Wynn and Mary's, they had good scenes together, the villain, I agree, you know, who came after them, she was really underwhelming. Like, this is the best that they could come up with, I guess. Okay, you know? For the Toy Man's protege to go after his family, like it was her family or that they meant something, really fell flat. And like, I agree with Tati, like if they just left it filler, that's fine. It's fine. You know, no big deal. And the reveal about Legion's true mission was uneventful. And I agree. Like, if you're coming all the way back to the past to try and stop something that's going to happen in the future, why wouldn't you want to tell people that information? Like, you're fucking working with her, with Supergirl. This is the person you idolize. And she's also essentially on the same mission. So it makes the whole "we don't get involved in past events" argument from previous episodes look really stupid, because that was their whole plan to begin with. So Mon-El was honest, yes, but I agree that they didn't need to have the same conversation more than once, since it's like they've been repeating themselves for several episodes. So they always have like three conversations of the same thing in each episode that they're in. And then I do have to bring up the fact that Kara wasn't central to this episode either. So I'm worried, because is her whole arc simply about getting over Mon-El this season? Because that would be really disappointing. So
yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. The Toy Man's Apprentice, like when she showed up on screen, I literally wrote in my notes like, "Who the fuck is this?" Because you know she was so like random, and her story and her connection to the Toy Man was like super weak. And I know that the actress, she was on like Grey's Anatomy, and she is way better than this crazy-ass woman that she played, fell in love with this psychopath. It really brought down the whole episode, and it was just, like, it was just really fucking dumb. And it would have been, like, much better if the Toy Man had just, like, if he was still, like, he could still be dead, but if he had set up a series of, like, elaborate pranks just to just fuck with them, then that would have been much better, because it would have been about Mary and Wynn overcoming this last monster, like, him still trying to control their lives from beyond the grave, himself. And right. Then overcoming that and defeating it would have been much better than this, you know, random-ass woman who thinks that she knows all or whatever. So I don't like that they kind of did, like, a cop-out with that. With regards to the Mon-El situation, I didn't like that it took him the whole episode to tell Kara what Emra lied about. And I didn't like that it seemed like he was using this whole, "woe is me, my wife and my best friend are lying to me, I'm so alone, Kara, will you spend time with me?" Like, it felt like it was not platonic. Like, it felt like he was saying this so that, you know, you understand me so well and so that it could go somewhere. But what I liked about it is that Kara was like, she picked up on it. She's like, "well, no, we're not doing this. We are not going there. So keep all of your drama over there." So I really love that, for that moment, that she put up some boundaries and was like, "we're not going to do this." But I just didn't like that he was trying to make it about, "it's me and you against my wife and Brainy over there." So
it also low-key made it sound like they were hooking up or something. Like, "they're lying to me together."
When he was like, "they lied to me," I'm like, "are they fucking?" Like, what is going on? They really lied, okay, so what, but they're not, like, together. And I also don't, like, I thought it was super weird that James and Mon-El talked for whatever reason, but apparently it was just to be like, "woe is us, we're working on it, our labor problems."
We're both unenthusiastic about our relationships at the moment.
Like, James, and he's like, "James, are you seeing anybody?" He's like, "no," and then he says that immediately, and I was like, what are you doing? Because this is not the first time that he's done it either. At first it was like, "well, it's because she's a Luther And then it was like, oh, maybe it's because she's my boss. And now it's like, oh, well, I don't know if we're in a relationship or not. Like, he's very nonchalant about the whole thing. And he's like, no one likes a reluctant romantic partner. It's almost like Barry Patty level of nonchalance. Like, she's just there. She wants to be in a relationship. So Barry's like, okay. And I feel like this is the same thing. Like, Lena's there. Lena wants to be in a relationship. And Jean just been like, okay. I don't have anything else to do right now. So I guess we'll be in a relationship, kind of. You know, but unless somebody asks me, and then I don't know, you know?
Yeah,
and
it is a really bad parallel for it to be Mon-El and Imra, and then James and Lena, because then that just means that Lena's on the Imra, Imra side of things.
The ships helm this show have sunk, guys. It's just...
It's really weird. I like that, let's see, I thought that James Wynn's subplot was great, but I didn't like that the other half of his plot was just blowing up Lena's phone, someone that he's quote-unquote maybe not dating, to, like, keep, like, blowing up her phone and blowing up her phone, and she's just, like, you know, not ignoring his phone calls until, like, the very last moment we find out what she's actually doing. And I think it would have been felt like, more for that, her, like, putting him to voicemail, if I actually thought that James cared that he was being sent to voicemail, then that would have made kind of some kind of feeling or whatever. But you don't even know if you're dating her in the first place, so what does it matter if she sends you to voicemail or not? Y'all aren't dating. So, but anyway, because it reminds me of, like, when Lena was blowing up Sam's phone when she was supposed to be on a work trip and she didn't show up and she couldn't find out where she was. I believe that because I believed in Sam and Lena's relationship. I don't believe right now in James and Lena's relationship because James doesn't believe in his and Lena's relationship. So it's just kind of like... contrast there. Hopefully he can get it together. So what are our predictions about what's coming up on Supergirl?
Carmel's coming back to life. now that she was like, stop this awkward train, the awkward train is gonna choo-choo its way back in. And then, yeah, I mean, other than that, like, Kara will obviously stop Legion's ascent, so into Blight. Or Legion's ascent. Kara will help Legion stop Pestilence's ascent into Blight. There's too many verbs happening. I don't know where that'll lead other than the Legion going away by the end of the season. But
you're always going away anyway.
Exactly. So
I agree, Caramel will rise, but will it stick? By the finale, Lena and James will no longer be a thing.
Oh.
That's where I see this going.
I feel like the show is definitely going to make it so that Imra and Mon-El have a conscious uncoupling by the end. And he, like, stays on the Earth while she and Brainy go back to the future or some kind of version of that. Because it just, you know, like we said earlier, just they're trying to make it seem like, you know, Imra and Brainy are one side, like they might be having an affair or something like that.
If they were, I feel like that would be entertaining. More entertaining than the secret he revealed. Like...
All right, well, anywho, let us move on to Black Lightning. So, as Jefferson is fighting for his life in the present, the episode takes a look at the past to Alvin and Jefferson's relationship growing up. Jefferson is going to work with his dad because schools are shut down due to rising over the death of an unarmed man by police. Gammy comes up to Alvin, concerned that he included names like Tobias in his expose about Greenlight and that the ASA was going to come after him. Alvin explains that Jefferson took the vaccine and now Alvin's doing what he needs to do to protect his son. Other flashbacks include Alvin playing the Name That Black Quote game with Jefferson and making Jefferson recite the Whose Life Is It motto, both of which Jefferson carried with him into adult life. In the present, Lynn begs Jefferson to come back to her, and Gammy has a heart-to-heart talk with Jennifer. He explains that Tobias is a gift for seeing the worst in people and that he takes drugs to extend his life and make him stronger. He now is with three men. Cyanide was an abandoned orphan that Tobias took in, trained to be an assassin, and then had carbon fiber body armor implants under her skin. And now he has Khalil, whose spinal implant produces a neurotoxin that causes instant paralysis. Jen thinks Khalil isn't too far gone, but Gammy assures her that he made a choice and her Khalil is gone. Gammy tells both Anissa and Jennifer the night he saw Jefferson's powers. Jefferson got caught up in the riots and was running away from police when his powers activated. In his attempt to run away, he runs into an electrocuted fence and takes so much energy he knocks himself out, but his powers don't really fully manifest until 15 years later. Anissa is getting antsy, and rather than walk down memory lane, she likes to take the fight to the ASA, and she's not wrong because Proctor and the ASA are closing in to track him down. Proctor is also looking for Tobias, who dropped off the grid after Black Lightning's death, but Tobias has no plans on hiding for any time long, I guess. I'm concerned with Khalil's positive. He dubs his news recruit Painkiller and reveals that he spent $1 million on a reanimation program to bring Lala back to life. The ghosts of haunting Lala were a side effect that he would eventually have the face of every person he's killed tattooed on his body, and earning him the name Tattoo Man. Tattoo Man's first job is to get captured by the ASA so he can blow up the headquarters with a bomb that Tobias made him swallow. Proctor realizes and escapes, but Tobias, Cyanide, and Khalil are already inside. Back at the cabin, Jefferson reaches a critical point, which initiates the final dream sequence in which an adult Jefferson talks to his dad about his death and apologizes for all the violence that he's caused to Black Lightning. Alvin assures his son that he's proud of him and peace isn't always peaceful, and then he sends him back to the land of the living where Jefferson wakes up, but without his powers. The ASA at the front door, Gamby and the Pierce family devise a plan for he and Thunder to fight so Lynn and Jin can get to safety, but Jefferson decides to suit up, powers or no powers. Jin, concerned for her dad's safety, going out unprotected, has a power surge and channels the energy into her dad, giving him enough energy to recharge his battery and get his powers back. Black Lightning and Thunder create a diversion while Gamby and Lynn shoot down the agents that make it inside. Family escapes just as Henderson and the cops show up to arrest the ASA agents. Proctor escapes the ASA before Tobias can get to him and moves to the remaining pod cat where the main pod kids are, but the Pierce family is waiting. Gamby reveals that Proctor isn't even the real ASA, and Proctor spouts more racist bullshit that Jennifer uses her powers to slam him to the ground, and then Gamby shoots him. Bye-bye, Proctor. The doctor on call with the pods say that they can't release him without something that's in a special briefcase. Lynn thinks she knows how to help them another way. The Green Light experiment is exposed to the city. Pierce family is safe and whole again. However, little do they know that the briefcase that they need is now in the hands of Tobias, and thanks to the collection of Proctor's thumbs, he opens it, and there's this green light emitting from inside, but whatever it is important enough for Tobias to claim that he is the new king of Freeland, and that is what you missed on the season finale of Black Lightning. So, a lot of stuff happened in this episode, but what did you like?
Jennifer Pierce has easily become my favorite character. The continuation of her story arc and the build-up from her never wanting her powers to using them to save her family was really great. The scene where she powers Jefferson, I didn't expect, and that was really awesome to see, like, the visuals and what it took out of her and all of that. And what I've always liked about her is how raw and real her emotions felt, and I think Chyna Ann McClain continues to provide such a great window into what Jennifer's thoughts and feelings are. She's scared throughout the episode, but she's also fierce and wanting to protect her family, and I love that. And it's so satisfying for me to see her growth and development, given how concerned we were that they weren't going to do anything for her or, like, kept sidelining her in the beginning of the season. So I'm glad that that turned around. I also like that Gamby got to bond with Jennifer before, or he bonded with Anissa before, and now he's bonding with Jennifer. And I like the fact that he laid out for her and how that provoked more of a thoughtful response from her besides outright anger like she had with her dad last week. And yes, Khalil did choose sides, so that's something he has to contend with. And I like that while Jefferson's MO isn't to kill, I feel like with the Flash and Black Lightning this week, we kind of had a similar back and forth, but this was handled better. So his MO isn't to kill, but Gamby had no problems doing that. But it's because he knows the ASA more intimately, and so I felt like it was more in line with his character and what we've learned about him throughout the season. And I love the flashbacks, obviously. I think they worked and fit seamlessly into the episode, and, you know, they were very heart-wrenching to watch because it's really the first time we were seeing Alvin and Jefferson interact beyond just the pain of having Jefferson watch his dad die. And I think that it was really fitting that Jefferson took Alvin's motto to heart and then used it to empower his own students later on in life. So that made me kind of emotional. And I like the aesthetic of the scenes and the relationship building between the father and the son and, you know, the black and white, everything. And I like that Lynn got to take action as well, but that it was so that she could get her life back, which really fits her character. And I love that she revealed how she knows how to shoot because she used to go hunting with her dad. So that was great. I like everyone's surprised expressions was really good. And another great moment, and one that I loved, was Lynn telling Jefferson that they had a connection. Because after last episode, I thought it might be over for them very briefly, for this season at least, until next season. But then she kissed him and he woke up, and it was a super sweet moment. And they're just so cute and adorable together. And finally, I did really love that the whole finale made plenty of room for family moments and that the themes of them being stronger together really shone through. And bonus, neither Henderson or Gamby kicked the bucket, so sometimes I'm happy our predictions are completely wrong.
Yeah. sometimes we don't want to be right.
Yes. And finally, finally, I really liked that Tobias became, like, truly central as, like, the villain of the season, and that he's the big bad, and he has the green light that's going to take over the city or whatever his plan is, and that he's going to be at the forefront next season.
The villain we deserve.
Yes.
But yeah, I totally agree with all this. Like, those flashbacks were beautiful, and I loved how much, like, insight they gave us into young Jefferson and into Alvin, which we didn't really have before. And also even into Gambi, which I would not have thought at the beginning of the season that I would want insight into. But, and it was a good way of, you know, like, pacing out, like, because Jefferson was literally out for half the episode. He's, like, sleeping. But we still got a lot from those flashbacks interspersed in that first half, black and white music. I love the black and white filter, and as always, the music is always on point, like, Black Lightning's music supervisor is incredible. I like the moments, like, we're seeing how Gambi was attempting to talk Alvin out of doing what he feels is right. And also we see how, you know, how Alvin lives his life and lives his motto that Jefferson wanted to live up to. And of course, that moment of Jefferson talking to his father in the living room as an adult was just, like, the perfect climax of that sort of coma, dream, flashback, whatever you want to call it. It really reminded me of Eric and his father in Black Panther, but, you know, with a happier ending. It was slightly fewer tears from me because of that. But it was nice to see how many ways Alvin has influenced Jefferson and how those methods and the mottos that he taught him are part of how Jefferson lives his life. And then, you know, Jefferson saying that he hasn't lived up to his father's expectations, and yet I love that line when his dad says, peace isn't always peaceful, because that's really, like, so accurate, so true for the show, but also in real life, you know, like, just because you advocate the peace doesn't mean that the way to achieve peace is peaceful, right? Sometimes you do have to do more. All the Pierce family moments were great, and including honorary member Gambi. I liked the little dynamics that we got, and I think this was the first time that we got to see Gambi and Jennifer really have a scene, because he's had a lot with Anissa, and of course all the time facing off with Lynn or partnering with Jefferson. So this was really a new extra dimension to the family, and that he treated her like an adult, and he really, like, sort of, like, laid it out for her, you know, like, this isn't Khalil isn't Khalil, but at the same time he's letting her, you know, like, he's not telling her not to do something, he's letting her make her own decision. And she made lots of great decisions this episode, because Jennifer is the best, and she's definitely become my self-fave. Loved her jumpstarting her dad's powers. And it's like, I knew, because I was sitting there, I was like, Jennifer can do it! Jennifer can do it! And finally, it happened by accident. Well, not even on purpose. But anyway, I loved it. Other things I was going to say. Oh, right, obviously, Jefferson and Lynn, you know, getting, I guess, they got together. Like, they didn't have a conversation about it, but obviously they were together. And they kissed in front of their kids, so obviously they're not keeping a secret. Like you said, May, I loved when she said they have a connection. It did give you, like, a little bit of, like, West Allen vibes, come home to me kind of thing. And everyone was badass, right? The metahumans were badass with their metahuman ways. And then Lynn and Gambi were also being badass. Everyone's, like, protecting the family. And obviously Jennifer is still a metahuman, and she got to do, like, cool, like, shooting, I don't even know, shooting lightning, I guess is what she does, but yeah, she did some of that, which was cool, but at the same time, she was also, like, with her mom more, so she's still straddling both worlds. I also liked Gambi just shooting Proctor, because no one else would do it, right? and also potentially for other reasons, but yeah, I liked that the season was a win, like, it ended on an unequivocal win for the Pierces, for Jefferson, even though there's still more to fight later. They still felt, like, fulfilled, and the community was really grateful, and we got to see, you know, even the police have to be like, vigilantism is bad, but thank you, Black Lightning, and Thunder, and Jennifer, but yes. So yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to season 2, and that's the best thing that you can say about the finale, right? It definitely made me happy and want more, so there you go.
I thought it was really funny after, like, Flash, like, 40 minutes of Barry, like, killing is wrong, we don't kill, and then I'm Black Lightning, Jamie's just like, bang, bang. You're dead. But I absolutely loved all the flashbacks of Jefferson and Alvin. I thought the choice to shoot them as black and white was, like, perfect. And it differentiates the scenes from just, like, normal flashbacks, because it makes it seem as if Jefferson's watching, like, the coma dreams or, like, your life flashing before your eyes. And these are all, like, key moments that led up to him becoming the Black Lightning and the man that he is today. It was kind of cool to see how much Alvin has had, like, an impression on his life, because he's pretty much just been a mystery and a ghost, like, hanging over the whole season, because the whole season has been about Jefferson not being over his death at the hands of Tobias. And so it's really nice to see, like, the actual man behind the ghost and, like, you know, to know that all these little things, like the quote game and the big things as well, like the motto, all these things that you look back at the season, you're like, wow, that's his dad. And how that has affected Jefferson as a man he is today is pretty cool to see. And it's like, Gambi has had a big impression on him as Black Lightning, but as the hero of Black Lightning, but his dad, Alvin, had such a big impression on the hero, Jefferson Pierce, the teacher, the educator. So that was really nice to see.
Oh, that's a really nice way to put it. I like that.
Yeah. And then, like, the final dream sequence with their goodbye, I thought was really sweet, and it was beautifully acted by both men. I thought that the music selection in that scene, Stairway to Heaven, was the perfect choice. You know, he's coming down the stairs. It's kind of like he's entering into, like, the afterlife to talk to his father, and his father's like, now you have to go back upstairs and go back to the real world. So I thought, you know, that whole sequence was just really great. Over in the present, Lynn's, like, come back to me seeing of Jefferson. And then when she kissed him and he woke up and that, like, dopey-ass smile, he was just like, oh. He's, like, so happy. And it was a really cute moment. I love Jennifer's conversation with Gammy, because Gammy is, like, the first family member to treat Jennifer like a fucking adult and tell her, like, the truth, and that she feel like she can handle information. And I also, on the other side of it, I also like that in this conversation you got so much backstory to Tobias, and especially Cyanide, because she's really grown from just being like a mute in the beginning of the season to essentially becoming like a potentially really dynamic and interesting character who speaks sentences sometimes. She always seemed to me like more interesting than Joy Toledo anyway, so I'm glad that she is getting more development into her character. I also love that he was honest with Jennifer about Khalil, and not just Jefferson's, like, stay away because I said so, but, like, gently, like, reminding her that Khalil made his choice and talking to her, again, with the situation as an adult. On the villain side, I like that Tobias named Khalil Painkiller, because I just think that's a cool name. So it has me kind of flip-flopping on whether I still think he'll become Static Shock later, just because I like Painkiller, and if he can make, you know, a good storyline out of that, I'm here for it. And if he's going to be a villain, I'd like them to go all in on him being a villain. And then, I guess, finally, Jennifer, my daughter, saving the day with her powers by, like, literally recharging her father. She saved her mother, her, like, lassoing Proctor's ass just for shits and giggles. And the combo hair flip eye roll was just the best. I loved it. So I'm so excited for her going further into season two and seeing how she develops. And then Proctor died, so it was a good day for me, because, you know, I don't like his ass. So what else did we not, well, what did we not like about, besides the fact that we didn't like Proctor, what else did you not like?
Yeah, just don't like him. Glad he's dead. Yeah, I mean, he was a dislike, because he's too, you know, mustache-twirling, malicious racist, who is kind of fake. You know, like, all right, it's not really like that. Or, I mean, some of them are like that, but that's not the real villain, right?
That's the real ones that you'd be afraid of.
Exactly. When they're like that, then you fucking know they're like that. The ones that vote for the one that's like that is the problem. So I would rather see the more systematic, subtle racism that causes real harm. And maybe they'll, you know, delve into that more next season. I did like that they confirmed he was even too racist for the FBI, the ASA, whatever. They're like, oh, I knew this couldn't be legit. This is too ridiculous. So that was good. But I hope that we get more nuanced villains in season two. Because I did feel like the season, you know, like, it wasn't as exciting in the episodes that Tobias wasn't in and that we had Proctor instead. Especially because Lady Eve had also died at that point. So those are the kind of villains that I'm looking for in season two. There were a lot of dropped plot threads during the season. I felt like they're like maybe minor ones to like maybe little character beats that were dropped, but on the one hand, it comes from only having 13 episodes, but on the other hand, you knew from the start that you were going to have 13. So there are some things that you don't even need to introduce if you're going to drop them. Yes, the biggest one, of course, is Grace. Like, I can't believe we literally saw Anissa leave Grace a message about, you know, potentially hanging out or hooking up or whatever, and we never heard about it again, you know? Like, it wasn't even like Grace isn't answering my calls for some reason. It was just, like, it never happened. Also, I pointed this out a couple of episodes ago, but, like, also, like, the whole thing with, like, oh, Jennifer, you dropped track, and you did this, and, like, you don't have a direction, and then, like, it's not like she found a direction. They could have just not ever said that she dropped track. So, like, I don't know. It's not, like, not a big thing, but I always, like, I thought that it was there for a reason, and instead it was just, like, nah. But in general, you know, we had been concerned with the lack of arc for Jennifer in the first half, and then the second half had a lack of arc for Anissa once Jennifer got hers. So it is kind of like there could be more balance for the two sisters. Like, they both can have an arc at the same time, or they, now that they both have powers at the same time, maybe they'll work together so that they won't have to separate as much. But I also, like, can't remember what Anissa does when she's not Thunder. Like, I know she's a medical student, or she is a doctor, or I'm not really totally sure, but we don't see it happen. We only see her be Thunder, or be Jennifer's sister. So maybe a little bit, you know, more outside. We don't want to get stuck inside caves, right? Like the other shows, basically, is what I'm saying. Let us be free of the caves. And then this is also just barely counts as random, but I thought Keisha, Jennifer's friend, was Henderson's daughter. And I remember that being a piece of information outside the show, but, like, on the show, like, didn't matter. So, like, it'd be cool if it mattered on the show. And then there's just little stuff like that, that they could have mined better, or that they could have found more ways to plot or to thread through. And then also, yeah, like, one big one is just, like, why did Tobias revive Lala? And why did he not revive his sister? At the very least, say, Lala's an experiment to see if you can revive your sister. But yeah, instead it was just kind of like, hello, here's Lala. Is it, like, torturing? Are you torturing him because he sucked before when he was alive? So now, like, you suck even when you're dead. But, like, he didn't treat him that way to suggest that that's what it was either. So yeah, it was just weird.
And he wasn't punishing Lala for Lala's crimes. He was punishing Lala because he hates Lala.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, now that you mention Anissa being a medical student, I realized what bugged me about the scene when Khalil made Jefferson stop breathing is that, like, your first instinct as a medical person, right, is to, like, try and remove his suit so she can, like, start CPR. But she didn't do any of the medical stuff that I guess I would assume she would do.
She was in shock, May.
Listen. Then she shouldn't be a med student after her shock renders her to freeze. Anyway.
Not the best medical student, clearly, is what we've learned.
Right.
She's Caitlin's no level of doctor.
No. Come on. Well, I do completely agree about Proctor. Like, we know he's a bad guy and he is an obvious racist, but, you know, he was also really too on the nose. I think I just liked even more the fact that he wasn't even working for the government anymore, so it no longer felt like a big problem of systems and large-scale racism in the country so much as a regular old radical bad guy who needs to be taken down, right? I also wasn't a fan of Anissa not getting much to do beyond physically kicking ass. It feels like her story stopped a few episodes ago, and we haven't really seen much from her besides her suiting up and fighting alongside her dad. And I think, as an older sister especially, it would have been nice had she gotten to have a heart-to-heart with Jennifer at some point. Because emotionally, there wasn't anything for her, and it showed. And I think it would have been a nice moment between the sisters, because besides maybe a couple of scenes, The Pierce family has felt like a great family, but I just wanted more between Jennifer and Anissa. And I did think we should have seen Foudy again. She kind of just disappeared. But like Tati said, there were a lot of plot points that kind of made an appearance and then disappeared. And I'd like to see them picked up again in season two. Specifically Grace, because I feel robbed. I mean, it was a pretty good season finale, but there were a lot of things that were... There were some things that were underwhelming. Like, yes, the explanation behind Lala's revival. Given... Like, they spoke about albinos and magic and Lala was reading a book about Egyptian, you know, the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And so I expected it to be something more spiritual, which would then explain all the visions of dead people Lala's having and also the tattoos, but we didn't really get that, so I guess that was a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, that was disappointing. I'm really upset now if they didn't go, like, the Egyptian route or, like, any kind of, like, mysticism. Because I don't know if they're doing, like, the whole we're trying to be a grounded show kind of thing, but you already have metahumans, people that can shoot lightning and stuff like that, and like, green light and drugs that give people superpowers. So why not delve into some of that just to give, you know, because there's a lot of cultural aspects behind Africa and the black diaspora and, like, mysticism and all that kind of stuff. Well, there's a lot of stuff culturally that you can still mine from black culture to include that in the show. And they just, a reanimation program, software, really? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because they were going really hard on the mysticism before, you're right. And then it was just kind of like, JK, no mysticism here.
When you're saying about, like, Proctor, like, he said, make America great again twice. And that's, like, super on the nose. And he's obviously racist is nice. It's still annoying. It's, like, even above that, it's, like, just annoying the fact that make America great again is, like, a phrase that is just, like, a thing now that has affected culture as, like, the racist calling card, and it just keeps showing up everywhere, not just in this show, but, like, in every show where they want to show some obviously racist person, this racist character says, make America great again, and it's just kind of like, ugh, do we not get enough of that from the actual racists in real life? Like, I don't really need this in the show. Yeah. And then, like you guys said, and this has almost nothing to do, like, plot-wise or any really strong emotional beats. And it's weird because the first half is really heavily focused on her and barely on Jennifer. And now the tables have turned. So all the emotional beats are on Jennifer, and Anissa has nothing left to do other than make rash decisions to go out and fight people. So it seems like her identity has kind of shrunk to just being Thunder. And like you were saying, like, you miss all of those outside elements. Like, we know what makes Jefferson Black Lightning and Jefferson Pierce, but what makes Anissa Thunder and then still Anissa on the outside? And so hopefully in season two, I hope they can find a better balance. And when you do, like, focus on Anissa, like, don't leave Jennifer, you know, over here in a corner. And I feel like they had a better bond in the beginning of the season with Jennifer and Anissa interacting together than they did in the late half of the season. So hopefully in season two, they'll be able to either bond over their powers, fight over their powers, something, and that they can balance out better stories for both girls in the same episode. Or even if they alternate, I just don't want long stretches of only Anissa and then long stretches of Jennifer, who I love, but then Anissa has nothing to do. You were saying about Lala's revival and Tobias. Technology did it was just, like, anticlimactic. And if he had, like, $1 million, why didn't he bring back his sister instead of, like, reanimating a slave out of Lala? I feel bad for Lala, even though he really doesn't deserve it because he's a friend. I just find it, like, uncomfortable, him not being in control of his own mind. And Tobias just, like, really doesn't care about him as a person. And there's also, like, the little uncomfortable with Tobias's anti-blackness thrown in there. And so it just makes him very uncomfortable. And then I thought it was lame that Tobias gave him a name. He gave him Tattoo Man, insinuating that he'd be around for a while. And then they essentially, like, blew him up a scene later. Or, it insinuated that he died. So I thought that was lame. To be fair, there was some time between when Proctor left the room and when it actually exploded. So maybe, like, Lala... And Lala seems to be kind of, like, weirdly unkillable as a zombie, so I guess that's kind of going into prediction. So I think that Lala the Undead is, wait for it, not dead. And that some of those better wake up in season two. And so that's what I have for my predictions. What do you guys predict?
I definitely agree that those pod kids better fucking wake up. They better not be asleep a whole damn season. But... I also haven't given up on Shady Gamby, even though I like him much more now. So I do kind of wonder if Gamby shot Proctor so quickly when Proctor was talking about him being a monster, because there is something else that Proctor might have said about his monstrous ways that we don't know yet. Because then it was weird. I don't know. I mean, then he was like, he's right, I am a monster. And I was like, okay. Like,
I feel like that would be, I hope not, because I feel like that would be redundant, like, Gamby would have regressed if he did that, so.
Yeah. I mean, I actually agree about him. Not that it'll necessarily be a bad thing, but I think him showing up in the flashbacks and shown to be arguing with Alvin about why he revealed the names could mean something down the line, not necessarily in a negative light, but like we'll probably learn more about him in season two. And I agree with about Lala, like, why kill him, bring him back only to kill him again? So I definitely think he's gonna be back.
More tattoos.
Yes.
More tattoos. But then we wouldn't know those people, so they'd probably have to include flashbacks so we can see why this person is haunting Lala. But so, we have completed set A, so now it's time to nominate a lady with gumption of the week for set A.
Ooh.
I'm gonna nominate Jennifer. Are you laughing because that was an obvious choice for me?
Well, it was an obvious choice, but also I'm just laughing because we had just given it to her last week, right?
Yeah,
if only we had known that she was going to have even more.
I mean, I guess runner-up would be Mary from Supergirl. But I feel
Mary?
Like,
oh, Mary.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry, Laurie Metcalf, because we don't know her as Mary.
Who is this Mary person?
But, I mean, for Jennifer, I just think that she showcased, you know, she just went in to give her father his powers back, even though she still doesn't really know exactly how her powers work and what and how to use them and all this stuff. So she's not like trained. She doesn't have a suit. She's not a full-fledged quote-unquote superhero yet. So the fact that she did that and then, you know, defended her mom but was also emotionally vulnerable, and she, you know, shot down Proctor, and then like her little eye roll flip, like, you know, Jess was talking about, was really good, because she's just like, at this point, she's like, you know what, fuck this. This is getting ridiculous and you're crazy. So I think she just had several strong moments emotionally and, you know, power wise.
I definitely agree with her for side A. Yeah. And, you know, and then Mary, of course, had her emotional, you know, like, having to come face her son after 20 fucking years and explain and apologize and then face, you know, her dead husband's janitor. It's all very difficult.
I'm gonna go all in on Jennifer because I feel like, you know, Mary had like a nice, you know, sad story, but she didn't defeat the crazy ass woman. So, but Jennifer, she still didn't even know what her powers do, but instinctively she was able to like recharge her father, mm-hmm. and she's using her power for someone that does not want their powers. She was using
really well, and that makes it even better that she was doing that. I agree. Yeah. I also, like, even, like, when she was, you know, doing it, people were like, oh, stop, it's gonna, you know, like she could hurt herself, like, you don't know, and then she's like, no, it's a little, you know, something will happen. Yeah, I agree, Jennifer's for side A.
Alright, Jennifer's for side A, that was easy. So, stick around, we're gonna take a small break, and then we're gonna come back for side B, Flash and Arrow, Rise Up / Long-Term Thinking, and we're going to also give you our impressions of episode 5 of Krypton. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hello, once again, and welcome back to episode 32 of Ladies with Gumption. You have reached side B, Flash and Arrow, Rise Up / Long-Term Thinking. I am your introductress with the mostress. It doesn't work. But I am Tatiana, and I'm still here with
May.
And
Jessica.
Yay. All right. You can still find us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter, at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. On Gmail, or Ladies with Gumption on iTunes, and Podomatic, and Google Play, and our individual Tumblrs continue to be Valerie M. Perez, if you're me, Her Own Hero Writer, if you're May, and Falling in Love in a Flash, if you are Jess. All right, before we get into our good old Krypton non-recap, we do have some more feedback from our lovely listeners, one of whom is Erin. Sir Megan Bacon, we adore you. So he opened up his email to us with, "Hey, my favorite ladies with gumption, finally had to email because I just can't deal with the disappointment of the golden child anymore," which is the biggest mood of all. It's for all of us. We all feel your pain right now. He's tired of Barry being stuck in the lab, but he did think that 18 was a solid episode, comparatively speaking, and you will find out if we agree very shortly, Aaron. He hates that we have to mourn Ralph, who was a nuisance but still got treated better than Wally did. And boy, did he go on a rant about Wally, which I agree with every word. Wally deserved so much better. Hashtag bring back Wally West. But anyway, not even Ralph calling the Flash family his, like he's a child playing with toys, makes it any better. Meanwhile, Aaron is happy to have DeVoe back, but he's not happy we only have 5 episodes left and we still don't know what the plan is. I feel that. So he's rooting for Marlies to break free and loving her chemistry with Iris / Candace, since that feels like more of an antagonist than Barry and DeVoe. Whoops. Yep. Marlies won round one at the courthouse, but Iris won round two in her office. Yes.
Yes.
Unfortunately, with Barry looking like an amateur, his only hope for the rest of the season is Don, Central City Citizen, and Marlies.
His only hope is Aaron's only hope, right?
Yeah, this is Aaron's only hope, yes.
Like Barry's not hoping for the Central City Citizen.
No. Poor Barry.
No, Barry doesn't know what that is yet. He'll find out, because he only looks at the part where Iris is still married to him in 2024, and he has not yet noticed anything else.
That's so, his only concern.
Exactly. As for Aaron's new favorite child, Black Lightning, he loved the finale. Jennifer's now on board. The Pierce family was at the heart. There's no more Proctor, and there's lots more exciting villains on board for season 2, and more of the ones that we already loved, named Tobias. But he does question, what about Foudy? Which I agree. He was like, good question, Aaron. I don't know what she's up to. Is she still going to work with Tobias now? Or does she just not do anything? And Jefferson never found out that she was a bad guy, right?
Yeah, that's, so, she was hooked up with Proctor, but Proctor's not hooked up with the ASA, so what does she do?
Yeah, So another drop plot thread. Bad favorite child, Black Lightning. Anyway.
Foudy backstory in season 2.
Yeah. Flashbacks for Foudy. Hashtag it. Okay, anyway. He hopes for more Thunder Grace in the future, and he wants to know if Lala is dead for good this time, and Jessica has already told you. Jessica has told you that no, he is coming back, goddammit. All right. Thank you, Aaron. Always feel free to ramble to us. We love your feedback. You always give great, thoughtful responses via Twitter, and so it was even better to see it all in one long feedback format. So, yay. Okay.
Woohoo, now, Aaron.
Yes. Black snaps for Aaron. So, Side B begins for real now. Sort of. It's still not real, because it's still Krypton.
Side Krypton B minus?
B minus. Okay. Y'all are going to be so excited when Krypton moves on up, like upgrades. Oh, and there's only 3 other shows to talk about next week. So who would like to go first with their Krypton impressions?
I guess I'll go. I love this episode because we got so much Jaina backstory, and I loved all of it. I love the flashbacks. I love the opening sequences with House Zod fighting. Really get a good in-depth look of what makes Jaina tick and why. And the reason why, despite the fact that she clearly loves her daughter, Lyta, is so difficult to consider betraying Ralph and siding with the Vexes to save her, knowing, like, her backstory makes you understand why it's so difficult for her in the present. Speaking of, quick rant, the Vexes are vexing me. And, like, if this is what Wallace meant by getting a more compelling story for Nyssa, she can just, like, throw the whole damn storyline away, just, like, throw it away. Like, I'm so, like, frustrated. It's way, like, the whole, do you love him thing that her father asked her? It's, like, too soon for her to have an I think I love him for reals plot, because Seg has done less than nothing for Nyssa to believe that this can be a thing between them, or to change her opinion on him, or think, because he's literally done absolutely nothing. Wait, let me back up, because he did do something. He thanked her when she's trying to manipulate him by giving him, like, his dead parents' ashes. So I guess if she's into guys that say thank you and they're totally in love with someone else, then, you know, if that's what turns her on, then maybe. It makes no sense. There's no believable buildup for her to actually change her mind, or because he didn't even have any like values of his own that she knows about. He hasn't gone to her, talked about his ideas for the future or any kind of thing. So this whole like I think I love him storyline right now is just bullshit. And then the only other thing she has going on is still like following her dad around. Like when she was talking to Jaina about, you know, pledge your loyalty to my dad, I'm like, well, fuck your dad. Like, if you're gonna be ambitious, like, be fucking ambitious. Like, her dad is just off, like, fucking Sagittari women, and that, you know, and not really caring. So, like,
it sounds like an astrology report. He's off fucking Sagittarius.
So I don't like the fact that, like, the two things that I hate the most about Nissa's storylines are the two that she's leaning into the most, and it's just, I would rather her take over the, like, government for herself, because that shows some kind of, like, ambition of what she wants to do rather than doing it for her father or, you know, whatever else that she's trying to do in that rant. So, like, I feel like the other parts of the episode, the Dev Lyta kiss being a good pie kiss, I was a little bit confused about it when I first saw it, but talking to both Tati and Maeve, like, it makes sense. She thought she was going to die, so it makes sense as it being, like, a goodbye kiss rather than an affirmation, because she would want to leave Dim with something happy, and he seems, like, genuinely really sweet and in love with her, so it was kind of a nice moment. Sex plot, like, surprise, surprise, was still, like, the least interesting. I don't see why he had to spend two episodes being locked up. Another rant, when the ice people showed up and talking cryptically about being afraid of the elves and how Black Zero thinks that they're important, I was just like, no. I can't handle any more fucking half-baked mysteries in the series right now. Either tell me why the fuck I should care about the ice people, or just, like, don't introduce the ice people. Like, I don't really care. I don't even care enough about the main plot for you to introduce a subplot, you know? So, like, just say what it is, or just don't say it. I love Adam Strange, and his delivering sex love message to Lyta was really nice, and that she immediately went into action to save her man. Adam checking out the male Sagittari was great. That's great. The Zod reveal was great, but it also makes my Seg Lyta heart hurt a little bit. I'm totally not dropping the whole Lyta is also Superman's grandmother theory, because it could still work. I just think it gets a little bit more complicated, because both of these men have to be born somehow, Jor-El and General Zod. Also, I just need Superman's grandmother not to be a fucking Vex. Just please and thank you. I feel like the characterizations as they are now, like, if Nissa was supposed to be as important as, like, Kal-El's grandmother, then they would not have introduced her the way that they did. So I still feel like it's going to be Lyta somehow, but I just don't really know how. And I do have a Krypton theory, but I'll wait for you guys to say your pieces, and then I'll drop it on you.
I continue to love the focus the House of Zod is getting. I think really the main reason I watched this show, to be honest, because they're just the best. They're so multidimensional, and Jaina getting focus was so good. The flashbacks to her childhood, how House of Zod has so much loyalty and pride was super disturbing to me, but really well done. And Jaina has never been the type of woman to show outward love to Lyta that we've seen so far, which is why I was happy for this 2.5 seconds she did tell Lyta she's been her greatest love, and then ripped my heart out to pieces when she followed it with her greatest shame. Like, that was super brutal. And Lyta's face, it was just, she was devastated. I couldn't handle it. And Tati will expand on this some more, but since we have seen, you know, Rao and the treatment of the Rankless and how it's done and disturbing and wrong, I'm not sure why dishonoring him is a bad thing either. So it does just come off as blind loyalty. So I hope that they expand on that, because you can be a super loyal and proud house, but also you should have mind of your own, I guess.
Right.
The Vexes. I'm not a fan of Daddy Vex's affair, which was weird and kind of creepy, since she, the Sagittari woman whose name I don't remember, she looks like she's supposed to be the same age as Nissa, and that was weird. And then Nissa and her storyline so far have been underwhelming. I totally agree with Jess, and I also don't believe she should be falling for Seg right now, because they haven't had any kind of relationship moments at all, and they've barely interacted, and I don't buy any of it. So currently she's just, I've called her the lurker because she's just using people and gaining information and kind of lurking in spaces to get what she needs so that she can have the upper hand down the line. Otherwise, she's not like a fully fleshed out character at all. And I did think it was really sweet that Seg sent that message to Lyta before he thought he was going to die. And I'm glad that he told her he loved her. But I'm still meh on him overall as a character because he doesn't seem to have a distinct drive going forward, and I think that's just an overall problem with the show. But I was surprised by the twist ending because I did think that based on Jaintna's flashbacks that he would be Lyta's uncle. So yeah. Not sure how they're gonna work with that moving forward, but I'm intrigued, and I also haven't completely lost hope in Seg and Lyta's future. So I hope something good comes of it.
I agree about the focus on Krypton. Yes, we are on Krypton. I agree about the focus on House Zod, and I really like delving into Jaina's motivations and sort of like the training and the kind of, not necessarily brainwashing, but like that's the kind of culture that she grew up with, right? That's why she is so loyal, and that's why she puts that above everything, loyal to her country, as it were. And so for her to then break free from that after painstaking thought, you know, comparing to how she let her brother die, pretty much, or we assume, we don't really know, I guess we don't really know what happened, but in order to be worthy of House Zod, now she's going to be quote-unquote unworthy of House Zod to save her daughter. So I thought that was really well encompassed in the line, "You are my greatest love and also my greatest shame," and it really broke my heart because you see, you know, she's giving up her honor to save Lyta, which is a great character beat for her. But then it's also going to further the angsty relationship and, like, the, you know, misunderstandings between her and her daughter in the future.
I feel like Lyta kind of picked up on that because she immediately went to Nyssa as, like, what did you make my mother do? Or,
yeah, I think she understood that that's, like, her mother. Like, like, she wasn't saying, like, "I'm ashamed of you because you almost died." She was saying, "You are my shame now because my love for you made me do this bullshit." Yeah,
exactly.
But it also left some impact for me just because, like May pointed out, like, I don't understand Krypton. Like, it seems like a really shitty place. Like, it's a bullshit bureaucracy. She's upholding a life that means a lot of pain for a lot of people. And she's part of enforcing that. So that's cool if that's what she was raised to do, which we see with, you know, with the flashbacks. But I wish that we got to see more of, like, what does Krypton do for anyone, you know? Because especially if you don't even know anyone else, right? Like, they don't think of other aliens. They're not really dealing with them. So why? What is the pride? Like, versus what? Why don't you just change Krypton? anyway. So I don't feel as much of a weight as she does, clearly, when it comes to the idea of overthrowing Krypton. Like, obviously, I don't like the Vexes, so I don't... And he specifically sucks. You know, he's gross. He's double-dealing. Fucking Sagittarius's. But...
like the Zodiac sign.
But at the same time, the voice of Rao is now also Brainiac. So, and he obviously wasn't doing anything for anybody before this point. So would we really lose out if power changed hands? I don't know. I don't know what would be losing. Anyway, I feel really bad for Devin. He loves Lyta so much. He is a cutie. And I like their little scene together because I just think that he really does respect her, and it does seem like he really cares for her beyond whatever arrangement they have that I don't fully understand, because she doesn't seem to feel beholden to him, like, or seem to feel like she has a future with him. But I did like that moment of them together, like when he said that he knew that he's in love with her and he knows she doesn't feel the same way. And then she kissed him and said that she loves him too. And, you know, you understand that it's not the same love, but she does feel a respect for him. She does feel kinship towards him, and she is grateful to him and everything that he's done for her. So that was sweet. I don't like that I didn't get enough Adam Strange, but that's okay. He's the only other person I like other than the Zod family. So I was like, what's happening here? But the moments that I did get were fun. You know, I enjoyed him asking around about Sag and the description he gave for him. You know, this kind of like, sort of like the quintessential, like, how would I describe the hunky male lead of my series was correct. And him checking out the Sagittari was, you know, who doesn't love bisexual Adam Strange? So that was great. Also, I loved when he gave Lyta that message And, you know, you see Lyta's reaction to Sag basically, like, confessing his love on tape. And, of course, Nyssa just lurking in the background like a crazy person. That's very soap opera of them. And I appreciate that. You lean into the soap opera of it all. Anyway, Sag himself, I could not bore me more. Like, I don't care. The only thing I care about when it comes to Sag is that Lyta loves him. Otherwise, I just don't care. I don't understand the family thing, like, the bit, like, the randos in the mountains want to destroy the L family, and I'm like, newsflash, they're destroyed. And then, like, when Sang said, oh, my brothers and my cousins and my whatevers are coming, I was like, you know, it's funny that I don't even know if you have those or not. Like, do you have family members? Could someone come? And so then you don't even know if these dudes know what they're talking about. So, like, maybe they're talking about some L stuff from 20 years ago that isn't even relevant today. Or maybe they can see the future and they are talking about whatever comes before Krypton explodes. We don't know, because we don't know anything about anyone in Krypton. Anyway.
That was my first thought, actually, because I thought of the... I don't know why, I guess, Supergirl popped into my head and, like, what her mom and dad were doing before Krypton exploded. So that was, like, when they said that, I was like, oh, could that be from the future? I didn't even think about what happened 20 years ago. I don't know.
That's what I have to assume. Like, I don't know. It was kind of like, okay. Because, like, they don't know what's going on now, but they sure know what's going on in the future. Okay. So, anyway, I love that, like, the Zod reveal at the end, except that I really thought he was going to be... I didn't understand. Before the episode aired, I clearly did not understand Zod family dynamics. So I was like, oh, he must be her dad. But then the flashbacks were happening, so I was like, oh... Her last name was already Zod, so she obviously didn't marry a Zod, so the Zod comes from her. Okay, so maybe it's her brother, like you said. And then at the end, he's like, I'm your son! And I was like, oh, okay! So, more time travel here. We already had Adam Stranger, now we've also got Zod. And why is he announcing himself? Like, is that not the number one rule of time travel? Like, you don't tell your mom I'm your son, but, you know, it's fine if you want to do that. And then it also kind of makes Seg Lyta feel like Nate Amaya to me, and I don't like that unless Lyta's like, this son sucks. I don't want to create him.
Wow. Like, that's going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. So now your theory, please. Tell me how it works.
So, okay. My Krypton Zod theory. Jaina betraying Rao is the start of the fall of House Zod. Because we know in the future that Zod's going to be on the enemy side and House of L is going to be like the heroes or whatever. And that Seg defeating Brainiac should be the start of the rise of House L. So Jaina betraying Rao, fall of House Zod, Seg defeating Brainiac, possibly saving. Because I don't even know if this Rao is the real Rao. If this Rao is like Brainiac, maybe like a real Rao is somewhere else. And so maybe like defeating Brainiac and saving the real Rao means that House L is going to be like elevated. So... if Zod is going back in time right now and he wants to defeat Brainiac, maybe he's planning to rewrite history to restore House Zod to honor by saving the real Rao and defeating Brainiac, therefore canceling out the first betrayal, and then House L never rises, which means no Jor-El and no Kal-El. There.
Oh, okay. I like this theory. I also have a question, which is, in the original timeline that Adam Strange came back from, didn't Brainiac not ever show up to be defeated? Because that's why Superman sent Adam Strange? Or is it like Savitar, where he was always going to come back and Adam was always going to come back?
There, because I read a little bit of an article when I think it was Cameron Welsh, who's the showrunner, was talking about the show. And he's saying that Brainiac was always going to come to Krypton. Adam was the wrong villain. So Adam thought it was Brainiac that they had to worry about when it's actually General Zod that they're supposed to be worried about.
Okay. So Adam thinks that the change is Brainiac, but Brainiac is not the change. General Zod is the change. Okay, so then that makes sense. Yes.
Oh, okay. I like it.
Yeah, then I dig it. Okay, now we get into the body of Side B, the real meat. So Jessica is going to kick off things with the recap of Flash. Rise up / long-term thinking. Go.
Barry and Ralph go back to the 405 bus to look for clues on the final missing bus meta, Edwin Gauss. They discuss battle tactics to take on DeVoe, and Ralph wants to keep all options on the table, including using lethal force, but Barry is not okay with that. Using the scanner, they find a heat signature of the person that Ralph remembers is Edwin Gauss. Henry calls him back to the lab to show off his giant tuning fork called the Sonic Scepter to replicate Izzy's sound wave powers, which they know can hurt DeVoe. Joe notices that Harry's a little bit too attached to his thinking cap. Iris talks to Caitlin, who has discovered that the highest concentration of dark matter is in her adrenal glands, meaning that all she needs is a shot of epinephrine to call out Killer Frost herself instead of being yelled at by Harry and Sisko. She reveals that she and Killer Frost are becoming besties, and they leave each other cute little post-it notes. Iris is kind of weirded out by Frost's sense of humor, but luckily this awkward convo is interrupted by a pocket dimension breach alert. Team Superpowers goes to the source of the breach, expecting to find Devoe, and instead find Gauss, who's startled back into his dimension out of sight. The team realizes they haven't been able to find Edwin because his superpowers pocket opening pocket dimensions, and Devoe needs Edwin so he can create dimensions without using his chair. The team thinks it'll be impossible to differentiate between Devoe's pockets and Edwin's pockets, but Harry and his cap easily narrow it down, so Iris splits up the group into Team White Folk and Team Brown Folk to check out the locations before he leaves. Joe texts in with Harry about possibly being addicted to the hat. Harry swears he's fine, but as Joe watches him enter the Star Labs Room of Requirement, Joe isn't convinced. Team White People check out the hippie compound on their list, where an unwashed flower child tells them that Edwin is a folded man because he's everywhere and nowhere. Caitlin unleashes her inner spirit penguin to look for Edwin, while Ralph and Barry have Killing is Bad debate part two. Caitlin finds Edwin, and Barry stops him and convinces him to come back with him to Star Labs, but Caitlin gets stabbed by a Samuroid, and Barry has to rush her back to Star Labs. The decapitated Samuroid taunts Ralph that he won't be able to save anybody. Caitlin is fine, but Ralph is pissed at Mr. and Mrs. Star Labs because they don't want to consider killing Devoe. Ralph talks to Edwin, who casually mentions that he's been to Devoe's lair, so Ralph gets the bright idea to go after Devoe by himself. Barry says not so fast and knocks him out. When he comes to, Ralph frustratingly tells Barry that he's not worried about Devoe will do to him, but what Devoe will do to his new Team Flash family. Barry doesn't want to lose Hero Ralph. While Ralph is sidelined, Mr. and Mrs. Star Labs agreed to use Ralph's plan to have Edwin open up a pocket dimension so they can get to Devoe. So Flash, Vibe, and Frost travel to Devoe's lair, where Barry immediately uses a scepter, but it doesn't work because it's a holovoe, aka a hologram Devoe. Real Devoe and Marlies and the Samurai came over to Star Labs, and they trap Harry, Iris, and Joe. Iris is forward thinking, uses an explosive earring she had Sisko make for her to get out of the room, and they split up for Joe to take care of the Samurai, Harry to get equipment to debug the computers, and Iris to get to the Cortex to use Devoe's chair to open up the portal. Harry has the opportunity not to use the cap, seeing as how he got violent and freaked out on Sisko when he thought Sisko had stolen it, but instead of taking Joe's advice to stop using it and consider that he might have an addiction, he uses the cap and pushes it to maximum capacity, overloading his brain. Ralph confronts Devoe, who sends him on a wild dinosaur chase while he devours the remaining metas. Ralph uses a different scepter, because Barry has one, but Ralph somehow has one as well, and blasts Devoe once, but stops before killing him. Iris and Marlies fight, and Iris kicks Marlies' ass before she opens up the pocket dimension to bring Barry and the team back in. Barry goes to find Ralph to see that he has changed and become a hero, but it's too late because Devoe said, haha, JK, and kills Ralph and knocks out Barry Sisko and takes Caitlin's powers before leaving to go back to his wife with a dark matter that he stole from Harry. All the metas are dead. Team Flash failed. Barry is sad, needs alone time, and that is what you miss on The Flash. So.
Woo!
Happy Day
Party!
Other than Ralph dying, what else did you like about
Rude.
R.I.P. Ralph. I really liked the second half of the episode far more than the first. I think it picked up momentum, and the lighting and the sense of, like, nowhere to go felt, you know, palpable. And I absolutely loved that Joe, after so many episodes of only being kind of just there, he was all up in the action and was the one to advise Harry about how bad of an idea the thinking cap was. And I'm still... While I'm still salty about the Francine storyline, the fact that Joe actually acknowledged her and what happened was really surprising and not in a necessarily bad way, so I appreciated that mention. I think Harry's slow spiral towards darkness has been decent so far and pretty good, and the fact that they made it personal by having him go after Sisko was good too, because that's his most important relationship, I think, on the team. And I was so engaged during the Iris and Marlies fight and loved the continuity of their conversation from the courtroom. And Marlies really thought she'd won. And then bam. Like, Iris, the boss, West Allen, stabbed her own damn self so she can get the upper hand. Like, what the fuck? This woman is a badass. And her get out of my office, whew, I saved that gif. Like, I was amazed. It was iconic. And it was a great fight. It was so well choreographed. Everything in the second half, I think, fight-wise, was well choreographed. And it had the right amount of suspense and tension and stakes. Joe taking down the samurai and then bringing its head, and Iris having like a plan B, literally like an explosive earpiece, was fucking amazing. The West family is just amazing. Beyond that, I have to say I did enjoy Caitlin's arc this episode, minor as it was. I found it intriguing how far she's come in terms of her dual identity, and was happy that she was actually coming up with a way to draw Killer Frost out herself without Cisco and Harry trying to, like, yell at her all the time. And I did like Folded Man, and I don't think that we spent enough time with him. And I loved seeing Neil Sandilands back on screen, because in the seconds that he appeared, he felt more menacing than all the other actors who played him so far. And as much as I still dislike Ralph, I'm not gonna, well, hate, I have never hated a character more, I do have to admit he had a good plan about going into the pocket dimension with the scepter. The other aspects will be my dislikes. And I thought it accurate for him to call Barry and Iris Mr. and Mrs. Star Labs, because he better recognize who owns the damn place. And I did like that Joe trusted Barry and Iris so much that he ended up rallying everyone behind them. And finally, I like that Barry got to knock Ralph on his ass after Stretchy Man tried to start something. And that it was, like, especially a good moment for me for various reasons. Because he did punch Ralph in the first half of the season, but that was just because he was just really annoyed with him. But this time, like, it felt more valid to me. And I did think Hartley did a good job being evil for the 30 seconds he was allowed to do so. And other minor things I liked. First of all, this episode was much better than last week's. And Barry and Iris respected each other's wishes. And the first being that Barry only wanted to, you know, go after the thinker. Or sorry, the first being that Barry only went off to find the thinker after Iris told him to go, even though she was injured, and then assured him she was fine. And then the second one was like Iris left Barry to grieve alone. So I think that they are consistently shown to respect each other in that kind of way. And they were very on the same page in regards to, you know, agreeing about a lot of things in this episode, which was nice to see.
I very much agree with that. I did like... Was that actually the end of yours today?
Yes, no, it's no. I'm done.
Okay. Like, I'm going to talk now. Anyway, I did very much like how they seemed to be on the same page, and they were, like, treated as sort of, like, co-leaders or co-owners or, like, whatever you want to call it throughout the episode. And I liked almost everything that wasn't Ralph in the episode. I totally agree that the first half was slower than the second half, and the second half really picked up, mostly because the second half didn't have as much Ralph. But we got to start with my badass babe, Iris, West Allen, who is an amazing leader, an amazing delegator, an amazing planner, and obviously an amazing fighter. So she's able to understand Ralph the Man-Child's point of view, which is incredible. Like, no one else can do that. She alone. She stands alone. But she also, you know, breaks up the teams. She has fucking backup explosive earrings to get out of sticky situations, which she told Cisco to make. And you know, she gets to prove how strong her love is and how far she is willing to go to save the day in that fight with Marlies. I love that fight, like, everything about it. The choreography was great. I love that purple lighting, like, because it just reminds you of Ren Ayers' run, and that makes you think of, I don't know, her legacy in the future, whatever. It was great. It was great. It gives me all the feels. Hanel Culpepper did a great job directing it. Both of the actresses were amazing. And I like that, you know, Iris didn't have the upper hand the whole time, right? Like, Marlies was making her work for it. And then she remembers that what her goal is, right, which is to get her peeps back. So then she does the stabbing of the self, which was very painful to look at, but awesome. Anyway, kudos to her. She did it all. She's the best. Yay! I love that she was the one that brought them back from the pocket dimension, because I like it when she saves the day. I wish we had gotten to see Joe take out the Samuroid, but the way that he brought it back, and he was like, all right, well, we're done with that one. I like that. That's just like, you know, a little bit of badass Joe that we can always use more of. But speaking of Joe, I did like how genuinely concerned he and Cisco were about Harry. And how Joe really took the time to sort of talk to him and, like, make him see that the way that he was behaving was, like, an addiction. And also that Joe is only talking about it because he cares and, like, because he feels guilty for how he tried to ignore it when it was Francine. I mean, I'm so happy that we heard about Francine, even though, of course, they only bring her up in the context of addiction. But thank God someone remembers her name. And it was nice to hear a different perspective on it, right? It wasn't just like, well, she did this and blah, blah. It was like, I ignored the signs that I don't want to ignore with you. And it is rare, I think, like, because Harry and Joe don't interact all that much. So it's rare to see that, I don't even know if I even call it a friendship, but camaraderie. But it was really believable in this episode. So, yay. I loved how the title, like, Lose Yourself, was a really fitting title. And it encompass more than just, you know, Ralph Death Day Party, the best. But it also included Harry, you know, channeling that dark matter, losing himself in the process, and then quite literally losing that dark matter because DeVoe was waiting for it and pulled it out, right? And also Caitlin losing Killer Frost, speaking of which, I very much enjoyed the friendship that was forming, albeit off screen, between Caitlin and Killer Frost, like them passing notes back and forth is really cute. And the fact that Caitlin's finally taking ownership of her powers and finding a way for herself to pull them out was great. It's like it's just really too bad that, you know, things I don't like happened. As much as I, you know, didn't like, I'm not writing a top 10 list, including that final West Allen scene. I did love the song that I was playing. It was a really beautiful song. It really added to the angst of the moment. It alone almost made me feel sad for Ralph. or rather sad for Barry, who was sad about Ralph. But yes, it did hurt in a good way, if you will. And Candace also killed that scene. Like, I don't know. I was really like, you feel like she was hurt that Barry didn't need her in that moment or didn't want her to help him in that moment. But she's also more hurt that he is hurt, you know? And of course, she's literally hurt. Because she's literally with her arm in a sling. But anyway, lots of layers there. So, I really liked Edmund Gauss as a character. He seemed like he had a lot of potential, which seems to be, like, the motto for this season. Like, oh, that metahuman has a lot of potential. Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I am happy that Neil Sandilands is back. Because he's the OG DeVoe, and he just does it the best. Like Marlies being like, that was how I felt, even though... when Marlies does it, and it's great. Also, Iris and Cisco shared screen time together. Woo! That's the best. Even though they didn't share as much as they could have, but they shared more than usual, so I'm going to take it as a win.
With Iris and Cisco, it feels like they have a close relationship, at least compared to her and Caitlin. Like, if you look over the season, it seems like Iris and Cisco are a lot closer now than they used to be, and are definitely more so than she and Caitlin.
Yeah, and I think for sure, helps.
Like, we don't see it, but...
Yeah, and I think it helps, too, that he was, like, there the 6 months, you know,
right.
Caitlin
was. Yeah. And that he's never tried to kill her. Anyway, like I said, Mr. and Mrs. Star Labs is great. Barry punched, like, when Ralph thought he was going to get one over on the Flash, and then Barry showed him what was what, that was also great. I love that shit. Just like when Ralph thought that he could get one over on the Thinker, or the Thinker showed him what was what. Also loved that shit. Okay, now I'm done.
Well, in a shocking twist, I too agree with you that half the episode was better than the first. I liked Edmund Gauss. I thought the actor brought a lot of personality into the role, and I thought, you know, Edmund was, like, fun. I thought the scene where Team Flash thinks that it's DeVoe coming out of the pocket dimension, but they almost catch Edmund, was hilarious. Just, like, they're like, what is going on? And all these looks about, like, I don't know what to do now. I thought that was really a well-played comedic moment. I thought it was cute that Caitlin and Killer Frost left each other notes and that she finally figured out a way to trigger herself. And I'm glad that they finally framed Harry's plot with, like, the thinking cap as an addiction, because it lessens the importance of all the shit he was doing and in regards to him versus DeVoe, and recenters the hero-villain showdown back on Barry, which is where it should have been, like, the whole time. I also like that Joe was the one to pick up on it and call him out. I hated the backstory about Francine when she was introduced, but at least it connected in a useful way here and showed that the writers hadn't just, like, forgot about her, even if they did do her dirty. I wish we hadn't just gone through all the other crap in the previous episodes with Ralph, because I actually did like the scene where he was explaining why he felt the need to kill DeVoe, because it was still kind of, like, childish, like, these are mine, it's my people. But, I mean, it's kind of like the first time where he's like, not because I want to save my ass, but because I want to save other people, this is why I want to do this. So, it would have landed better with me if I didn't have all the other times of him just, like, regressing and all that kind of stuff. So I feel like they kind of, like, it muted the effect of that scene for me. But I still like that he said it. I cheered when Barry finally got to knock Ralph out, because I felt like that was what was missing for me in the last episode, so I'm glad that he actually got to do it. I love that Iris was a boss this entire episode. I love that when they were deciding to take on DeVoe, Joe asked Mr. and Mrs. Starlabs both what they thought they should do, because they're both leaders of the team, and it's just another way to show the whole We Are the Flash concept. Iris continues to show that she graduated from the School of Lunar Snark, because when the plan that they made and executed went off the rails, she had a backup plan in the form of an earring bomb. So I thought that was great. And her fight with Marlies was epic. Not only the fight choreography, but also, like, the reference to the courtroom drama. And I just love, like, their dynamic with each other going back and forth. And her stabbing herself was just, like, a badass thing to do to win the fight. And may I just say, like, how smug I am that it was only, like, the non-powered members of Team Flash that actually won their fights, Iris and Joe. And I had some fanboys, like, try to argue with me, like, well, Iris didn't actually win because she got stabbed. I'm like, well, she stabbed herself, first of all. So she still did it, and so she won. So, you know, sit down. And then also people are like, well, Ralph also won, but, you know, and I was like, well, how did he win? How do you win if you die? That's like the opposite of winning. Like, and if y'all think DeVoe came all this way to Star Labs just to get bested by a pair of handcuffs, like, you have not been paying attention. Like, the only reason he allowed himself to be handcuffed is because he knew he could use Kilgore's powers to get out of it. So, you know, Ralph was never winning that fight. DeVoe always had the upper hand. So, you know, like I said, two people actually won their fights, and they were two people that didn't have any power. So thank you very much.
Woohoo!
Yes. So what did we not like about this episode?
Obviously, for everything that I did like, there were also several things I did not like. I personally wasn't triggered by the final scene. I thought it was fine, and I thought it was in character, and I didn't think Barry was being disrespectful or mean. But what I did dislike was that it was given so much importance due to Barry mourning Ralph's death to begin with, which, you know, okay, I guess. He was on the team, and I felt bad for Barry feeling bad, but I didn't feel bad for Ralph's demise. Like, he got mood music and rain. I don't know. I just felt it was way too dramatic for the type of character that he has been so far. And I was annoyed that most of the episode was reduced to talking Ralph down. Like, while his plan, he did come up with a plan, but I didn't like the fact that he was adamant about it to the point that he tried to pretty much take over leading Team Flash because he was unsatisfied with things not going his way. Like, Ralph, you have been on this team for 2 seconds. Chill. Just a little bit. And he tried to act like he was better suited to run Star Labs when you can barely be a functioning hero, much less act like you can lead. So that was a joke. And his behavior, once again, like, it wasted so much time. And while it was nice that Barry was equally adamant about not killing, it just made him look like less of a hero in the end, given all that happened. Barry does have reasons for not killing, which he could have mentioned, and that could have made the argument more interesting, in the same way that, you know, Iris thought he'd lose a part of himself if he did last season. But instead, it just made him look like, it made him look less than Ralph. And that's something I didn't like. So all Ralph's death will do now is just kind of fuel his guilt. In terms of hero moments, I thought it was odd that Ralph didn't just kill DeVoe like he wanted to. Like, I disliked the fact that his reasoning for why he wanted to kill the villain was all of a sudden about him wanting to protect the team, when for the last several episodes that hasn't been the case, and it has only been about saving himself. So he never seemed to overly care about the team, like, the way that he expressed this episode. So it felt to me, not that it came out of thin air completely, but that he has been reduced to whatever he needs to be in the episode. And I think it would have been better had he sacrificed himself to save the team in the final hour rather than decide just not to kill DeVoe. Emotionally, Ralph's story has been all over the place, and his reasoning behind his actions never have any lead up, and so, like I said, they only exist to serve what the plot needs to be in any given episode, and that's frustrating. So, like, his inconsistency as a character has always been a problem, even down to his final moments. So I do wish that they would let Barry come up with the plan rather than waste so much time on trying to point out point Ralph's moral compass in the right direction. And I dislike that what seemed to be a West Island scene in the promo was cut, minor as it might have been. And I honestly think Ralph's entire hero arc was wasted because he didn't even go out saving anyone and died anyway. So he didn't end up being a real hero in my eyes. So, like, miss me with the "see, I didn't kill him" bullshit. It just felt hollow and pointless, and I'm tired. So that's why I wasn't really sad about him leaving, or, you know, for the moment, at least for the next few episodes. I did dislike that the episode 2 didn't really have any time for heartfelt moments and took too long to get going. And the show just seems to lack a general flow at the moment. Like, Cisco, for example, absolutely could have briefly spoken about the offer Breacher gave him last episode. And Iris maybe could have been seen writing a little bit, you know, after Run, Iris, Run. So that's a bit frustrating. There doesn't seem to be any, like, character continuity right now. And, like, if we're not going to get to the main plot, at least give us some further character development besides, for everyone besides Ralph. And finally, I find myself frustrated with the Flash around this time every season. And we don't know what DeVoe's big plan is. And what I need this show to do now is, like, dig deeper with the plot and the characters in the next few Ralphless episodes so that we can get the show on the road. And finally, while the bits about Caitlin and Killer Frost getting along was great, I think getting rid of Killer Frost fell flat because it lacked any buildup, because we haven't seen Killer Frost and Caitlin really interact in a while, and we've only just learned that they exchanged notes in this episode, so why not just sprinkle that into a few episodes before getting to this point? I felt that would have been more impactful, even though we probably know she's going to get her powers back later on. So it's just, the second half was really good, but there were a lot of frustrating aspects in it in the first half.
I totally agree with your major point there at the end about the lack of consistency and flow from episode to episode, because it kind of just feels, yeah, like they're kind of going in circles until they get to the big battle or to, like, the next change. But this time, they don't have that same kind of passion driving them that they have in previous seasons. Especially, for example, I would say season 3, you definitely felt the drag in the second half between when they should have found out who Savitar is and when they actually did. But because it was such a specific fear hanging over their heads, like Barry could lose Iris, and, you know, Joe would lose Iris, everyone would lose Iris, but really it's Barry who's driving the story, it also felt focused. You know, even if certain scenes repeated themselves, they were emotional and impactful because they are based on the characters and their fears and what they want. Whereas this half, second half of the season, it's just the only stake was that DeVoe might kill Ralph, and we wanted that to happen. So nothing else. So nothing else really feels, you know, like there isn't, like you said, there isn't development for the characters. Things happen in one episode and then they're dropped until they're next going to happen. Just like Caitlin spoke with, or, you know, remembered that Killer Frost remembered in episode 15. And then it was not even brought up again until this episode, and only so that Killer Frost could die and so that we care. It's like telegraphing to you that it's going to happen, you know? I would, you know, the only character who I guess has consistently every episode gotten to do his thing is Harry. I mean, aside from Ralph, because Ralph is eating the show. But Harry, every episode has that, oh, I'm going to do the, you know, the cap. But even that doesn't go anywhere. It's just like, watch me do this cap again and know that this is going to go badly soon. Soon it will be bad. So yeah. Hopefully next season they focus on, I think that part of it might be like they were so intent on wanting to do a non-speedster villain because that's what people wanted. People were tired of speedster villains, but they don't have a drive to do a non-speedster villain, and they don't know how to, clearly. Like, they tried to do a really smart villain, but they don't know how to write it being smart. My friend Leo said, like, he's not smart, he's just read the script. Like, all he's doing is just knowing what's going to happen in future episodes. Because, like, there's no way that you could deduce that just from logic or probability or being smart. You know, that's not what intelligence is. It's not like you're their personal psychologist, you know? I agree with that, and it makes for a very poor second half of season 4, outside of the 2 filler episodes that we're now moving the plot forward. So, more filler. You need more filler in your life when you're not going to actually move the plot forward. Now on to the rest of my dislikes. The time spent on Ralph is garbage. Everything that Ralph does is garbage. He's a garbage monster. And his sudden insistence on killing DeVoe was as random as everything else about him. Like, he's never brought up that he thinks that DeVoe should die before. Now suddenly it's like, oh, kill DeVoe, because that's the plot of this episode. That's, like, the moral or the theme. So that's why he feels that way this time. His motivation changes every single week. And it's, like, it's weird because in the first half of the season, he was really unlikable because he's gross and he's, like, misogynistic and he's just clearly an avatar for AJK. But because of that, he's also a more consistent, he was also a more consistent character with, like, a specific motivation, because he was being written by someone. In the first half, he was being written by someone who appreciated that kind of character. So at the very least, he was consistent. And so now it's like they still have to keep him going, but they obviously don't feel that way, don't feel the same way about him as the writers did in the first half. So now he sort of loses consistency and he is just as much of a blob as his powers. Anyway, point being that I didn't feel like Barry was given enough arsenal for his argument. Like, I agree with him. Killing is bad. And we know he's right. And we know the show thinks he's right. But there are actual reasons that he could give why killing is bad. And there are reasons that probably could have been written in more efficiently. And it would have helped, I think, to bring up the fact that he did kill Menas in season two. That the show wants to ignore, you know? But everyone remembers that he did it, and everyone brings it up whenever he talks about not killing. So just bring it up in the show, so he can say how that made him feel, right, and how that haunts him, and how that wasn't the solution. And then even how Iris feels about killing Savitar, even though she didn't really kill him because he was going to die 2 seconds later. She just prevented him from killing Barry before he died, which he was going to do. But anyway, point being, she still, you know, pointed that gun and shot him. So bringing up the experiences of people who actually did it would help. Just like Iris did when she talked to Barry about Oliver. And she said, Oliver is weighed down by what he's done. He has to live with those consequences, and I don't want you to have to. And now Oliver's going to jail, so that makes sense. See? There's correlation there. But anyway, the fact that they are nerfing Barry to the point that Ralph is the one coming up with the plans to stop DeVoe 2 episodes in a row, or to stop the villain, or whatever, you know, is unacceptable. Like, Barry should be smarter than this, right? Like, before, they would dumb him down so that Sisko and Caitlin and Harry could give him advice on what to do, or so that Iris can, you know, give him a beautiful pep talk that we all love. But now to do it so that Ralph can just get some in there too before he dies, it's just nonsense. Like, there's too many people that Barry is now dumber than and have to stop. Must be stopped. Speaking of which, Barry's wife was fighting DeVoe's wife, and Barry's father-in-law is fighting DeVoe's creation. And then Barry's friend Ralph is fighting DeVoe himself. Like, that is not the order of things. It's not the natural order. What is going on? I can't with that. I mean, obviously, I guess if I loved Ralph, then that would be great. But it feels off-center in much the same way that other shows, like Supergirl, feel off-center because they're not in any way roaming around Kara. So that's what The Flash is starting to feel like a little bit. And they really gave Ralph Barry's role in the story. It's like if Wally really had spent season 3 being the one training to save Iris, instead of, like, just having that one arc where he was going to try to do it, and then Barry was like, no, it has to be me. Like, this is, like, that arc, but 8 episodes.
To be fair, now that Ralph's gone, Barry's like, it has to be me.
Exactly. That's what I'm asking. He'll be like, it turns out it still has to be me. What do you know? Especially because now, you know, Harry tried that fucking cab one more time and it exploded on him. I guess it's gotta be me, guys. I tried to get out of it, but here I am again. So, yeah. Stop knocking Gilgross out 5 seconds into a fight. It makes her seem totally useless. Like, why? Like, now she's gone. And it's like, well, she wasn't really helping before, was she? So yeah, that sucks. I don't like that. Like you, it felt like it lost its impact that she lost Gilgross. Even the fact that she couldn't feel that she lost Killer Frost was weird. Like, you had just started to connect them, so why wouldn't she know instinctively that something was wrong when it was pulled out of her? You know? It was just weird to me. I was like, okay, so you're not that connected. Again, more reasons to not be that sad.
She didn't leave her a note that said she's gone.
Goodbye, Kaylin. I love you. Goodbye, Katie. There you go. Anyway, another thing that annoys me, it's like a little thing, but like, Cisco's vibes are not powerful enough to stop whatever DeVoe's dimensional thing is. And it's been that way all season, but it's like literally just that way so that Cisco can't use his powers as much. And it annoys the shit out of me because, why? Like, Edwin can do it. Why can't Cisco do it? We just decided Cisco can't do it. So, anyway, I don't like that. It's got to stop. I am salty they cut a Willis Allen moment. I don't care. Every time they cut a Willis Allen moment, like, don't let me know you're going to do that, guys. Don't put out a still Willis Allen moment and then cut it. Why would you do that? But as for the final scene, I'm a little bit more, like, I was a little more put off by the reactions to it than to the scene itself. Like, the scene itself, I was like, well, thanks for that. But the reaction, like, Barry just asked, like, he asked for space and Iris gave it to him. And I understand, like, I get that the real problem isn't that he said he needs space. It's that people feel like Iris isn't going to be comforted, or that Iris isn't, you know, that she has to be strong for other people and people aren't strong for her. But this season, more than ever before, they have let Iris express herself and they have let Iris break down. So yeah, like, season 3, that was a huge problem. But this season, like, she got to yell at Barry and tell him how she felt, and he apologized in 402. She got to be freak out about the wedding even in 403, and he had to calm her down about that. And when he was in jail, he had to be strong for her, you know? Like, so it's not the only time that, you know, she is not the only one now that is being strong for other people. And so I would hope that next week someone will ask Iris how she's holding up, and I'm sure that she's not going to walk around with her arm in a sling all episode long for people to just ignore it and be like, Iris, can you grab me that coffee? She's like, hey. I'm sorry.
And I actually think it's really important that she's still in a sling, because it shows that that was a major thing that she did. It wasn't just like, oh, well, you know, she's fine.
Yeah, and I remember in season 3 when the sling was, like, or the cast, whatever, she had it on at the end of 312, and then 313 she didn't have it anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I feel like it's going to be okay next week, all right? Barry was, you know, he was a bad boy, but it'll be fine. Finally, my biggest complaint is that it's been 18 episodes. The whole team has done nothing but lose. Unless you're Iris, then you're winning. And also Joe a little bit. Like, you're either not doing anything or you're winning sometimes with Iris. But the whole team is just a bunch of failures. And they now have 13 dead metas on their conscience. And the audience is no closer to knowing what DeVoe is up to than they were before. So this has to stop. This has to stop. Please let them win sometimes. And please let us know what it is that we are trying to prevent.
We know we're supposed to be enlightened, but we haven't been enlightened yet.
That's, like, a good point, because I was thinking about that, too. Like, every season, it's like Barry has to lose all the way up until episode, like, 2021, where maybe he starts winning a little bit. But, like, and it's the same formula. Like, let your hero win and let the villain sweat it out for a minute and have to, like, pivot and do something else. Like, the villain doesn't have to be the one that's always, like, 10 steps ahead the whole fucking season until, like, he messes up at the final moment. Like, let there be some back and forth, I think would be a major, it would help a lot with terms of the season and the storytelling and keeping people engaged. As far as this episode, I thought the second half was a lot stronger than the first half. Ralph's protect attack speech. It bothered me less than it bothered you guys. But in the whole kill versus don't kill debate, I have a different view, because I get Barry's point. And I know a lot of people are like, well, they should have just let Ralph kill him and then we would have been done with this. But, like, people with powers needing to find other ways to resorting to killing, because they're not operating on the same level playing field as normal people, you know, because you got that saying that absolute power corrupts absolutely. So if you are already, you know, more powerful than the normal person and you use your powers to kill because it's a quicker, easier solution in that moment, then that can obviously lead down to, like, a slippery slope where you, superpowered individual, play judge, jury, and executioner with everybody. And so you may be right in that some instance or that first instance when you thought that you had to do it, but, like, the more that it becomes easier for you to kill, I think it's just a dangerous precedent to set, and I think that's what Barry was trying to say, and they could have expressed that better, because I think that would have been, like, a stronger argument other than just killing is bad. And I know some people were like, well, how is Iris going to say killing is bad when she killed Savitar? Well, first of all, like, Barry specifically is saying, like, especially since they do have powers, they have more of a responsibility to find other ways other than killing people. Iris had to kill Savitar, or he was going to kill Barry. She didn't go out with the intention of Savitar has to die. That was just something that happened in that moment because of what he was about to do. And then also, with her and her gun versus Marlies, she wasn't there was nothing saying that she was shooting to kill Marlies. She could have been shooting to disarm Marlies, and that would have been totally fine. So Iris is not being hypocritical at all by siding with Barry and saying that killing is wrong. And she still, and she even, like, with Ralph in 16, she was telling him how it felt for what she had to go through with Savitar. And the, I don't know if she talked about with Ralph, she talked about somebody, the weight of having to kill Savitar, you know, does play on her mind in the background. So it's not like she just killed and just forgot about it. So that's that. I hate that a bunch of metas just, like, died off screen. Like, for example, Melting Point. And I'm frustrated that Killer Frost is gone, even though I knew it was going to happen anyway. It's kind of comical, to be honest, because she never got to do anything while she was here, and now she's gone. And none of the actual interesting stuff with Killer Frost even happened on the screen. So all this stuff about her and the guys hanging out off screen, all of her, like, I got blood on her jacket. Well, I didn't see the blood. You know, what fight was she in that she got blood on her jacket? And why did she come out in the first place to get blood on their jacket? All this kind of stuff that would have been much more interesting than just Caitlin sitting around in Star Labs to see. We didn't get to see, and now we won't get to see it for the foreseeable future because Killer Frost is supposedly gone. So I don't like that. And I know she'll get her powers back, but, like, then what? Like, what is left to this story for Caitlin? It just seems like a lot of wash, rinse, repeat storylines with her, even with Killer Frost. Writers don't really seem to have found, like, a home for how they want to develop her, so it's just kind of, like, a meh kind of thing. I hate that Marlies seems to be relieved that Clifford the Body is back, so I hope she realizes just as quickly that just because he looks the same doesn't mean that he's back to the way that he was before, because I do need her to escape and, like, hop over to Team Flashside so she can help them defeat her husband. I thought for Wes Allen, I thought that they felt strangely disconnected all episode. Like, they were working together, and they had scenes where they stood in the same frame together, but they didn't really interact with each other. And I thought that was weird, especially not in the way that we're kind of used to seeing. They just were kind of there together. And then as for that particular scene at the end that Tati's talking about, that Phantom, the Phantom reaction also kind of annoyed me a little bit more than the actual scene. Like, I didn't necessarily like it, but I don't think it was as bad as some people were saying that Barry's being insensitive or uncaring, or anything like that. Like, sometimes people just need a damn minute. Like, when Henry died, Barry actually flashpointed, so at least he's staying in the same timeline this time. And then I didn't feel like it was out of character. This has actually been, Tatiana actually made, like, a gift set of all the times that Barry has said that he needed space. This is clearly, like, nothing new for Barry needing space from Eve and Iris to kind of, like, sit in his feelings and sort it out. But in this season in general, it's been building up for a couple of episodes that he's been, like, cranky and stressed out about DeVoe being one step ahead and the bus metas that he's been trying to save all season keep dying. He's, like, snapped at Cisco at least twice about, you know, do this faster, let's go faster, and all this kind of stuff. So he's clearly been stressed out for a long time. And so I think the fact that he, with Ralph, he invested so much time in Ralph to get him to be a good person and a hero, that to see him finally accept being a hero and then die was just kind of like a straw that broke the camel's back. And I think the fact that Iris knew where to find him or where Barry was going when he just ran off proves, like, there's still that connection where she knows him the best. But I also think that after taking on the role of the mentor and watching Ralph die, and on top of everything else, he didn't really feel like being comforted in that moment. And sometimes, like, you just want to, like, wallow in your mistakes and feel the weight of him. And I think that Iris, even though she doesn't want to see him hurt, because she's hurt too, because the whole team is hurt because Ralph's gone, she doesn't want to see him hurt ever. So she offers to share that load, and he's just like, no, I don't want it right now. I want to feel bad because I should feel bad because I failed, kind of thing. And she kind of understood that this is something that he had to go through by himself. So I didn't really see it as him rejecting her. I just saw it as more him wanting to sit in the atmosphere of, I did, you know, this is my failure, and, like, deal with it by himself. Now, if next week, if he's still acting and pushing people away, then I'll say that that's a little bit out of character. But for this, the weight of this moment and where Barry was, I felt like it was, you know, in line with where the episode needed to go and where Barry needed to go. So I was fine with it. Tonally, just the fact that they hadn't connected the whole episode, and then you have that scene, you know, it was kind of disappointing. But as far as for where Barry is mentally, I didn't think it was too out of character. But moving on to predictions, where do you predict this going?
I have a prediction. You know, mine usually suck. But I think... Oh, thank you for that, but they do. Or they never come true. It's fine. Barry, I think Barry's hero arc will turn out to be saving the bus men in the end. So him getting out of the Speed Force and indirectly giving them powers, even though it wasn't really his fault, will come full circle, and any guilt he's felt will disappear so that he can actually end the season happy. And my second prediction is that I think the finale will have a 6-month flash forward to October. We'll see West Allen move into a new house. There could be a potential pregnancy announcement, and then Dawn will show up, reveal who she is to set up season 5 and say, "This house is bitchin'." Yes.
Well, you better not be wrong on this prediction, because I know. It's literally the same as yours.
I feel like, so. Yeah, I feel like it's the one that kind of makes the most sense in my head. For what could happen.
At the very least, he will save Ralph, but hopefully he will save all of the Metas. And the question is just, will he save them by literally going back and making sure they never get the power so that Avo can't defeat him? Or will he save them, like, fighting in the mind state? And then, like, if he releases them from the mind of Devo, then he somehow also releases them in the real world, you know?
And then, again, you out, like, if you, like, freeze a bus meta and then just like come out of like Clipper's
body. That's literally what I'm imagining. Which will be interesting sci-fi wise, because you know they already lost their bodies, so shouldn't they just be like amorphous, you know? But anyway, moving on. I assume that at the very least Ralph will be saved.
Tobias can resurrect them.
Yes, Tobias can resurrect them. But here's a little bit of our reasoning for the house is bitchin' moving stuff. So Candace posted a picture of Zoe sitting on top of moving boxes on a day that we knew she was filming. And one of those boxes read literally pictures, you know, like in all caps, like moving box writing. So either she was literally moving out of Katie's place, like not just like taking a couple stuff for hiatus, but like literally moving out, that she would have to take a whole fucking box of pictures, or it was a set piece, right? And since Candace's walls are white and the ones in the picture are brown, I assume it is actually from set and not from her literal apartment. And that same day, Grant posted a video of himself in the Flash costume, so obviously he was filming, coming out of a house, which also had brown walls. So, we are assuming...
That's the case.
Yes. We are assuming that West Allen will get a house in the finale. Like, maybe it'll be, like, a flash forward when everything's over. They move into their new house. And then John can show up and let them know that this house is bitchin'. So, fingers crossed. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Well, I'm not going to add on to this because I agree to it. But I also hope that Dawn shows up at least once more before the finale. And I think she's supposed to show up. Paparazzi said that she filmed at least, like, a day for episode 20, maybe. So yes, we'll get, like, a little mini Dawn, and then she can move in with her parents into their new house, and she'll be excited and say that this house is bitchin'. Next, we are moving on to Arrow.
Finally moving on to Arrow.
And I was not drinking when I watched Arrow, so I remember it. But I wish I was drinking, so...
I was drinking, God. And it didn't do anything.
Oh, well, okay.
And I was sad.
Basically, this is gonna be like my crappiest recap ever. But basically, Diaz is like, "Oh, woe is me. I was bullied as a child, and now I'm gonna bully other people. Blah 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 blah. And now I want to join the cool kids table called the Quadrant and run all of crime all over the world." But then the snotty nose crime lord, son of the crime lord, was like, "You have to audition. You just can't sit with us." And so he has to like go and like find this dude, and then the crime lord son is like, "Haha, JK, I'm gonna kill this dude and you because I don't want you to sit with us." And then he's like, "Well, shit." And so he goes and back, and Laurel's like, "Why are you even like trying so hard to impress these people?" He's like, "Because they're cool and I want to be cool too." And so he goes finds like a crime lord's son, and he's like, "You lied to me. Like, I want to go right now." And the crime lord is like, "Well, you know, you're a thug, thuggy, thuggy, thuggerson. So thug, 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 thug." So Diaz killed him because he doesn't like being called a thug, and so he like goes, takes him to the quadrants meeting, and blows him up there. And, like, fight, fight, kill, 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 stab, 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 scream, scream, scream. And he finds the table, and the crime lord's son's dad is like, "You know, we wanted to kill you and take Star Labs, or Star City because you're a thug, 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 thug." And he's like, "Don't call me a thug." He's like, "You are a thug, loser." He's like, "Well, bang, bang, you're dead." And he's like, "Well, there's a seat open now." And so he sits down, and he's now in the quadrant. And then on the other side, Curtis and Felicity, since she was fired by her husband from a job that she didn't get paid for, now she has time to work on her startup company with Curtis. But she's still worried about Oliver because he's not answering her calls, and she doesn't know where to find him. And she thinks that he died in an explosion, but then he comes back, and she's like, "Well, I want to know where you are." And he's like, "Well, you know, you'll live." And then she's like, "Okay." And that's when he missed an arrow. So...
the best recap ever.
it does tell us exactly how much we missed on Arrow.
Yes.
Did you like anything about this episode?
I liked Laurel's wig. I thought that it was believable. And it was very wise, given that Laurel is alive now to the public. And if she walked around in her black siren outfit as Laurel, then she would have problems. So good job, Arrow, for consistency. I also loved her mocking Diaz and his middle school ways. And I like, you know, that she got to use her black siren scream against the quadrant dudes, even if it cut immediately after she began participating in the fight, so we could not see it. I liked that Felicity and Curtis acknowledged that Helix exists, and that they made up so that they can be friends. And I liked that Felicity expressed how isolating and scary it is to not know what the fuck your husband is doing, where he is, or if he's even alive.
Yes, I agree with all of this. Laurel's wig was great. It was the only thing that I really had to say, except other than this episode just exists. But it is the best of the CW wigs. Props, CW. You stepped up. I'm also happy that Felicity kind of, sort of, called a truce with Curtis so they can begin working with Helix, working on Helix after 84 years. And yes, Felicity getting to express emotion and fear for Oliver's safety, and her obviously being affected how she couldn't be in control over anything outside the Arrow Cave was a pretty good emotional thing for her. And that's it.
Did our resident correspondent, Tasha, have something to say?
Yes, Tasha had quite a bit to say. She, you know, wanted to let us know the episode was not good. But since we are now talking about things that we do like, she did like that Black Siren appears to finally be about to pick a side. Side note, Katie Cassidy is great at playing bad. So there's that. She also liked the action sequences and the fact that Felicity got to express her frustrations and fears in the Felicity scene.
Okay. For me, I liked Laurel's wig. I liked that it felt like she was kind of like the devil angel kind of thing, like sitting on Diaz's shoulder. Like if Diaz was like an actual crazy person and Laura was like a figment of his imagination, and she was just like mocking him from within his mind. That's kind of like the feeling that she had. I liked that part from like Laurel's role in telling Diaz how dumb he was for trying to impress these people. And I guess, yeah.
The saddest.
Dislikes.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's just kind of funny because it's like, it's not even like it was like a, like, it's not like bad, horrible things that we disapprove of and that we are offended by happened. It was just literally like, I just spent an hour of my life watching this and I don't know why. but anyway, things I did not like. The fact that the dragon is named after his own fear of, like, literally being called a loser. Like, that's his fear. That's like, the demon inside him was so dumb. I can't. Like, I wish he had just called himself the dragon because he thought it sounded badass. Because that's... I can't believe I'm just to care about a villain that cries himself to sleep over people thinking that he sucks. Because, like, now I just feel like even I could defeat him with just, like, the power of my apathy. And then at the end, he, like, he killed the dude who called him a loser like a billion years ago. But like, I don't. Was it cathartic? Like, were you really that pressed? Like, he's like a fucking Twitter troll.
A winner to defeat like his childhood. Like, I'm one now, so you can die.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what? And then also, like, why did it take him 32 years to kill this dude? Like, what have you been doing for the last 32 years of your life that now is the time that you've ascended high enough to go kill this rando? Speaking of, what have you been doing? How has it been 6 years of this show and we don't know about the Quadrant until now? Like, we literally don't even know about the Quadrant earlier this season. This is, like, the first episode where it was brought up. There weren't even, like, Hansel and Gretel crumbs to lead us to the witch. Just, bam. Quadrant, this is the new thing. It just really reeks of poor planning, poor plotting, and just, you know, just like, I ran out of ideas now. I don't even, like, it's like they didn't have an idea at the start of this season. And now, because what even is Oliver, how is Oliver related to this, you know? I don't know, whatever. Everything's bad. Also, Laurel, where does your doppelganger daddy think you are? How are you running out on him like this? This man's giving you his house. He feeds you. He's clearly taking care of you, and you are running around with his, you know, enemy, watching this dude kill people. Go back to your room. Think about what you've done. I loved her sassing Diaz all episode long, but then why the fuck is she following him? Like, how? There's no self-awareness here. Like, she's making fun of him for being a pathetic lapdog, but she is his pathetic lapdog. So, what are we doing here? I can't wait for her to abandon his ass. I'm tired. But yeah, it hampers her character because, again, it just puts it back in the position of Black Siren, or Laurel is just there to cater to whatever dude is around, even if she's a badass because she thinks that dude is lame. But then what are you doing here? So, like, she's already found more meaning in, like, the few scenes she has with Quentin than she ever has on the villain side of things, you know? Because we'll never know why she is doing the villainous thing she's doing. Anyway, no Oliver's a bad move. It was no dumb, very no good. Like, I may drag, you know, Oliver to hell and back. And sometimes Steven too. But it is his show. Like, it's called Arrow for a reason. People tune in to see Arrow. You know? And so to not have him for the whole episode except for that one scene, like, especially when your story this season is not strong enough to prop anything that is not what is Oliver up to right now. And the moment that he did show up, all it did is remind us that he left Felicity to fend for herself for the whole episode with just her worries and her being fired. And he, like, basically, like, pats her on the head and is like, you're strong enough to handle it. See you next time. Like, no. And finally, as much as I love Curtis and I love his friend with Felicity, I thought it was going a little too far. Like, first, she apologized, which whatever, you know. If you think that they were, that NTA was in the wrong and OTA wasn't, then you wouldn't like that. But that aside, if she apologized and he had said, hey, I'm sorry for how we handled it too, great. But instead, she tells him that Diggle left the team and, like, Oliver fired her and all this bullshit. And then he's like, oh, I'm trying really hard not to feel satisfaction or whatever. And I was like, what? You don't have to say that. Like, just say you're sorry and move on. Oh, my God. So, like, that was too much. Everyone needs to unclench. That's all.
I agree. So my likes were very short. I basically disliked everything else. I totally agree that benching Oliver was a bad idea on a show called Arrow. Like, choosing to focus first of all on a villain who absolutely no one has an investment in is the worst idea you could ever come up with. The big bad dragon wanted to join the Quadrant because I thought it was gonna be daddy issues, and it turns out that wasn't even it. He was just mad someone called him a loser. Like,
we prefer daddy issues, like, right? It's like white boy school shooter.
Right, daddy issues would have made more sense given that the show is built on daddy issues, but that was not the case. Like, I don't know anybody who wasn't bullied or made fun of as a kid, but you took it too far, dude. Like, this is extreme. And, you know, I didn't know who anyone in the episode was, and I did not care. It was anticlimactic, it was underwhelming. Diaz's story was poorly paced, poorly executed, lacked in drive. I feel like no matter what the show's issues are at any given point, this was one of the worst episodes I've ever seen. And that's saying something. Because Diaz as a villain, he has a trash story. And, like, this is what you reveal to us. I thought it was going to be more compelling. And I just, besides Diaz, though, I did dislike that Oliver basically ditched Felicity. Like, he wants to fly solo. I guess that's fine, whatever. But it looked like abandonment to me, especially since she was really worried about him. So I don't know, maybe like give her a call. That would be nice. I also dislike the fact that he did kind of seem dismissive of her worrying. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal. And reassuring her he'd always come back to her or whatever fell flat because there was no buildup of it throughout the episode. So it just felt like meh, because that was his only scene. So it's not like there was this big ordeal. It was just like one-sided where she was worrying about him and then he just shows up and is like, it's fine, it's all good, I'll always be here, but meh, I guess. Anyway.
Did they kiss this episode?
They did.
Yes, they did. That was, yeah. I should have put that in the links. I was glad you finally got a kiss after like six episodes.
Yes. It was about after time. So many episodes of just keeping your hands at your sides.
I think anyway. I must have blinked and I missed it.
But I mean, like, I guess to me, like, the whole promising thing just felt crappy considering just last episode he fired his own wife from her job, which is, I don't know. Finally, I do want to know why the hell Laurel is working with Diaz. Like, her powers alone, she could rule the fucking city and be the queen. So get it together, Laurel, and leave his ass. I don't understand why. I don't. Anyway, nitpick, but there's no way Renee is only now getting out of the hospital. And I know Jess doesn't like her at all, but where the hell did Elena even disappear to, right? Like, so many questions, so much stuff that's happening I don't know the answers to.
She left town with Foudy.
Elena and Foudy on the road. Yeah, like, the whole premise of, you know, if I cared about Dragon at all, then this would have been, like, a very interesting look into the villain. Like, if this was Prometheus and we got a whole Prometheus episode, then that'd be great. But the fact that no one cared about Dragon in the first place, and the fact that his whole MO is based off of, I had to, all my life I had to fight kind of thing, is just, like, really ridiculous. And you kind of do feel like, Laura, like, why are you trying so hard to impress these people that we've never heard of? And, like, the whole snotty crime lord son was just stupid. The whole, like, white-on-white Latino crime when he shot him. And, like, the fact he was like, I want to see the tables. Like, what's called the quadrant, not the pentagram, like, dumbass. Like, there's not five C's, there's only four. So, so, like, the whole thing just felt kind of dumb. And then, like, you guys have already talked about Oliver and Felicity, and I don't even know that I cared that much to come up with a dislike for that scene. So off of what you guys said, there wasn't really enough of it to really, for it to be like a substantial plot thread.
Yeah, like, if Oliver had been in the episode, it probably would have felt
seen Oliver better. like fighting or you know, failing at being alone or something like that. Right. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. Whatever. predictions.
Wait, before you predict, you gotta let Tasha say her feels.
Oh, yeah.
Disliked.
What did Tasha not like?
All right, here we go. The bad. Even though the Elysium seems under the good, it is also under the bad. Because while Oliver is trying to reassure Felicity, his positivity felt dismissive. She wasn't upset about it because she thinks there's going to be a parallel, which is also a prediction that Felicity will put herself at risk to stop Diaz, and that's when Oliver will realize how she's been feeling. Hoo-hoo. But at the same time, it is like, why didn't your trackers work, Felicity? Don't you have trackers in his boot? Did he turn them off? Why do you not know what's going on with him? Great question. Also, she didn't like Felicity apologizing to Curtis. She said that if she had apologized when he first quit, that would be fine. But after that, he sided with Renee, he tampered with Diggs' chip, he kicked him out of the hospital. So at this point, she thinks that Felicity would push back or argue when someone that she cared about was harmed. So it's weird that she just agrees to work with Curtis and apologizes to him without actually having conversation with him about where they were wrong, as well as OTA was wrong. And again, she thinks it's plot over character. They wanted Felicity to express her concern about her husband, and so they just decided to do it with Curtis. Now, she also thinks that Diaz is an uninspired blend.
She doesn't have any other friends.
She doesn't have any other friends, yeah. Pretty much, it's just Curtis. Diaz is an uninspired blend of Frank Bertinelli and Chase, and yet they both did it better. He's not interesting, he's not captivating, the actor adds nothing. The episode told him he was bullied, so he grew up to bully others. Yep. She doesn't know if they wanted him to, if they wanted her to feel fear or feel empathy, but she didn't feel either. And I totally agree with this. My predictions are what I already said, which is that Laurel will realize she's tired of Diaz being a scrub, and she will finally help the team against him once it's too late, and my man Quentin is dead.
I actually agree with this. Unfortunately, I don't want Quentin to die, but I feel he's definitely a goner at this point, because Laurel's sudden change of heart isn't going to come from nowhere, because she's proven herself to still want to do bad things and run off with criminals, so.
She did tell Diaz not to mess with her daddy, so Diaz is going to, like, be the responsible dad's death, and then she's going to go off, and I don't think she's going to join Team Arrow, but I do think that she will help defeat Diaz.
Oh, okay. Tasha has several predictions. She thinks the quadrant is a seed for next season, but she hopes not, because she would rather have Joe Wilson and the Jackals. She thinks that Oliver will beat the stuffing out of Diaz, and Siren will turn on him, but he will hurt Quentin. Sorry, Tatiana, cry emoji. Yes, thank you. Thank you for feeling my pain. That is my man. Anyway, but yeah, she thinks that he will hurt Quentin and Felicity. Although, you know, Quentin will probably die, and Felicity will just be a little hurt. And then she said, I promise you, Felicity, I will always come back. Foreshadow much? I watched that scene and all I could think was lies. Oliver, you're going to jail in 4 weeks, but the finale isn't called Life Sentence for nothing. Yeah. She's right. That's correct. And you know who else recently did that? Except they did in the middle, so it was fine. But Flash. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying Flash also did that. Everyone's doing the jail thing. Everyone's doing the jail
thing.
Yes,
that's true.
What the cool kids are doing.
Exactly.
So, nominations for Lady of Gumption of the Week for Side B.
Yes. Go. Guess who I would nominate.
Is this really a competition on the side, though?
No. Well, you have Krypton, so,
that's true.
There's
like,
There's also Krypton. But you could
the obvious choice from The Flash.
Yes.
But I would also throw out Jaina for Krypton, because of, like, the fact that she went against everything that she grew up to believe was her identity to save her daughter.
Yes, I agree. They're both good options. I feel like, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously I always want to nominate Iris, like, and she definitely, like we already said, she did it all this week. And she was a leader, she was a fighter, she proved, you know, her love is stronger than Mona Lisa's, and also brought back the team, and made it to Barry's PI office and back, apparently alone, while her arm was in a sling. Did she drive herself? Did she have to Uber there? Did she walk? Who knows? She made it happen.
I think just the fact that she stabbed herself... Like, that's just, I mean, that's just like a whole other level. I'm watching here, I'm sitting here watching the promo. I was like, my God, Marlies is going to stab Iris. I don't want Marlies on the team in the future. Fucking Iris stabbed herself. Okay.
And now we can have Marlies on the team.
Yes, now we can have Marlies on the team. But she did it for various reasons to prove, you know, obviously she loves Barry to the moon and back. She also wanted to save her team, so she wanted them to get back from the little dimension. So she did that whole thing just to press the little button and get an upper hand. She also had a plan B. She wears explosives on her ear. I mean, that's amazing. So, I don't know.
So let's put Jennifer, Jaina, Iris, JJI.
JJI, all right. I mean, I feel... Just because Jennifer won last week, I feel like it's between Jaina and Iris. And so I agree with you that, like, emotionally, it was a really hard hurdle for Jaina to overcome, you know, and to finally choose love over honor or fear, whichever option you want. I would say love over fear, because I think that the honor is, you know, low-key bullshit, because all of that, everything about Krypton's society is bullshit. But, yes, she did choose love, and that is what matters. So, yeah. Emotionally, I think that she had a very strong arc this episode, and physically, Iris had a very strong arc this episode. So I'm fine with either one. I hate choosing. I hate decisions.
Amazing in that face. Just say what you want to say.
Okay.
Say what you need to say.
I completely agree that Jaina had a strong episode emotionally, which is great because this. Emotions and women, you know, are always put down, which is a problem. But strategically, and physically, I guess, Iris had the upper hand because she was being smart and had to calmly talk down a child. Which, trying to understand his perspective, too, which, you know. And I think she was just ahead of the game in a lot of ways. And there was, like, a ton of metas in Star Labs, and she came out on top, so I don't know.
Okay, yeah. So, I wouldn't go Tatiana's route as far as discounting Jennifer just because she won last week. Because if you have gumption, I think then you should just... If it's 2 weeks in a row, someone's got to be the first to have 2 weeks in a row. So, and I thought that she had, like, a lot of good moments. I think that if I'm going the, you know, how many lays of gumptions are you winning, then Iris already has, like, two, and Jaina has zero. So do I go that route? Because Jaina did have a really strong emotional arc, and the whole House Zod is built on power and gumption and fight. So they're already, like, have the physical, and then for her to go against everything and go against everything with, like, scum people, the Vexes, it was just, like, another aspect of her, how hard it was for her to break everything that she knows because she loves her daughter. But then also, like you guys are saying, based off, like, if I'm not discounting Jennifer for possibly winning 2 weeks in a row, I also can't discount Iris and the fact that she was making boss moves, and she did have backup plans. She thought ahead. She had a plan to get out of the situation they're in. She saved the team and brought them back from the pocket dimension. So it's kind of like there are different pieces for each one, and so it's kind of difficult to.
We could also have our first tie.
A three-way tie.
Because we can't decide.
Except there was too much gumption this week.
There was too much.
I feel like I'm leaning Iris, though.
Oh.
I feel like I should, because she's won twice already, but I feel like I'm leaning that way.
Okay.
But I'd be fine with a tie, because I also... But I don't know if House Zod might stand alone, so...
Yeah, I mean, because it's hard, because Jennifer can't win again, because this is the end of the season, and...
Yeah, that's true.
Damn it!
And I don't know, maybe we should do a tie.
I don't think Jennifer drove her episode, though. That's the only
thing. No, she did not. She definitely did not.
She had a lot of good moments that stood out in her episode, but she didn't drive her episode. Jaina drove her episode.
Yes.
Iris drove the part that she had in her episode.
Yes.
But she wasn't, like, the driving force through it. But she did shine in those moments, and they were more central to the episode than Jennifer's, a little bit more than Jennifer's were in Black Lightning.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, okay, alright, okay, so...
As long as the airport.
we'll be here until tomorrow, we can't decide. So, I guess, are we discounting Jennifer?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So
Jennifer's like a runner-up, good job.
Yes.
So, you want a Jaina and Iris tie, or one of them?
Let's put up Jaina and Iris, and then a poll to see what everybody else thinks.
So I love it. No. We're gonna poll.
Oh...
We can't decide, so you let us know who you thought had more gumption this week. Jaina from Krypton or Iris from The Flash. That is all the time we had. You spent a lot of time with us today. If you made it all the way through to the end, because there was a lot.
You get Black a cookie.
Black Lightning is not returning next week, so Krypton will have space to move up there, and we can shorten this podcast out a little bit. Come back with us, and we'll see you next week. Have a good weekend. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.